So what we might do, we'll just give it another couple of minutes before we start, given there's such a big queue. While we're waiting, can I welcome all of you in the room, but also the people on the webinar? So there's about 100-odd people booked on the webinar, and there is about 100-odd people booked for the room. So we'll wait just a couple of minutes if you can be patient, and we'll get a few more people in the room. While we're waiting, though, I can mention a couple of housekeeping matters, I suppose. First of all, we do have a number of guests here, or at least scheduled to be in the room. They might be trapped downstairs. So we have representatives from APRA, ASIC, AASB, AALC, and the ATO. And we will hear from APRA and the AASB a little later in the morning. I might just go to the agenda so I can talk a little bit about the agenda while we're waiting. So that's the day as planned. I've got a feeling, though, that we're going to have to be a little bit flexible about this because it's a bit hard to judge how it's actually going to flow. So forgive me if I cut you off in the middle of a discussion because I may have to just to keep the agenda moving. At the same time, if there's a really good discussion, I might let it stretch a little bit. Okay, so just bear with me and I'll do the best I can. Okay. Right, we sent out a search party, and here are a few more. Come in, guys. Those of you on the webinar will be able to send in questions, and we'll do our best to address them. And I should point out to everybody that we want as much interaction with you as possible. So each of the speakers will talk for a bit, and then there'll be time for interaction. We will pose some questions to the audience where the answers will be a show of hands. I'll give you a sample of that in a minute. And at other times, guess who's read it? Yeah. At other times, you'll be given an opportunity to raise your hand and ask questions. I'm not sure whether we'll be able to deal with all of the questions. There's an awful lot to get through, even though we do have 4 hours as part thereof. Okay, let me keep going, I think, because people are still coming in, but we can't wait too long. First of all, just a reminder of the purpose of the task force. And that was to help prepare the actuarial profession for the implementation originally of IFRS 17. And we deliberately decided we would have a focus on Australia rather than the membership internationally, focus on Australia. The task force itself has got about 14 members and support from the Institute. We set out to ensure that we had life, general insurance, and health insurance representation. And the intention is, as you would have seen, that the information note applies to each of those sectors of the insurance industry. So again, very deliberately, we've tried to have one information note and one, in effect, one set of standards. We set ourselves some principles, which may need to be massaged a little bit, I think, but let me just tell you what we set out with. The idea was that having produced an information note. It should allow an experienced Australian actuary to implement the requirements of AASB 17 without having to refer to international actuarial guidance. We'll hear more about that very shortly. And we wanted to avoid duplication of what might be done internationally as well. But as that's evolving, I think we do have some overlap, and we'll need to change the approach that we take over time. So what about today? Well, this is what we hope to achieve. First of all, we want your input on the information note. And basically, are we on the right track? Is this a useful document or not? And if it's not, then we need you to say so, right? Because there's a lot of work gone into this. And if we're not delivering something that's useful, then we should turn around and do something different. You'll have a chance to have task force members and a few others explain their thinking and give views and opinions. You'll have a chance to hear the views of your peers when they speak up. You'll have a chance to ask questions. And hopefully, at the end of the day, you'll get a better understanding of AASB 17 and its implications and where we're up to. Now, all of that should lead to a revised, updated version of the information note. And as you'll see, I think what's going to happen is that we're going to have to regularly update it as understanding and interpretations evolve. So far, we haven't had a lot of feedback, except people saying, "Gee, it's big." But Chris Schuber and some of his colleagues did put together a fairly substantial piece of feedback, and I thank them for that, and we'll address their issues formally in due course. But it was useful input in the meantime. Otherwise, we haven't had a great deal of input from you, and I'm taking that as a good thing. We'll see how we go. Now, interpretations are a bit of a moving feast, and they will continue to keep moving for a while, and others will speak about this in a bit more detail in a minute. Importantly, we need to recognise as a profession, this is an accounting standard, not an actuarial standard. And we might have a view on how something should be interpreted, but often actually that won't be up to us. It will actually be up to the accounting profession, the accounting bodies, to determine how these things might be interpreted. So that's important to note. It's not an actuarial standard. Today we don't have time to discuss interpretations in depth. We could pick on various items in the standard and go uphill and down dale on them. We don't have time to delve into them in great detail. There certainly will be some discussion about them. What we do want to know, though, is where you're having trouble with interpretations. So if we haven't picked up on issues where you think interpretation is not clear, then please tell us, because we need to do something about that if we haven't got something in train. Okay, so let me start with a couple of questions for you. And I'm just going to ask you for a show of hands. And unfortunately, the people on the webinar, I'll give you the feedback, but we can't see your hands, of course. I'm going to start with a very simple one, and that is the length of the document. I already said it's pretty big. So is it too long, too short, or okay? So too long, would you put your hands up? Okay, so that's probably a third or so. Okay. A bit more. Okay, and too short then. Are there any too shorts in the room? Yes, one here is too short. Okay, somebody wants more. All right, so I'm going to take that as okay, right? So we might trim it down, but we're broadly on the right path. Next question then, is there too much technical information? That is it delving into the technical matters too much or not enough or okay? So is it too technical? Put your hand up. Okay, there's nobody putting their hand up. Is it okay? Okay, majority of people in the room, and that means there are a few that say maybe it needs a bit more technical stuff. Just out of interest, are there many people in the room who think that their implementation will be determined by the international group they work for? So it's all very well for us to be sitting here saying this is the way we want to do it, but if you're dictated to by somebody in Europe, say, just put your hand up. Okay, so that might be 10 to 20%. All right. In due course, we'll ask you if there's anything you'd like to see changed at a high level. And now a yes or no question. Do you think the IN, as we stand here, I might ask you this again at the end of the day, do you think the information note will serve its purpose broadly as it is, right? So are we on the right track? Is it going to serve its purpose, that is, to help this profession in its implementation of the standard? So yes. Okay, so I'd say that's a little over half. Just put up no. Okay, that's okay. So that was a very strong majority, in other words, so I didn't judge it very well. And one last question. In due course, would you like to see the information note evolving into something more substantial? So the information note has no authority. The Institute has guidance and it has standards. Would you like to see it evolve into either guidance or standard? So leave it as an information note, put your hand up, and something more substantial, guidance. Okay, so it's pretty clearly an information note at the moment, and maybe views on that will change in due course. All right, so let me move on here. We've covered some of these things already. Now, what we want to do now is hand you over to, first of all, Adrian Rees from APRA, and then John Ree. Is John Ree here? John Ree, hi, there you are. That's great, from AASB. You've each got a few minutes, and we might take the opportunity to see if questions come from the audience as well. So, Adrian, if you'd like to start, and then we'll come back to John Ree.
Thank you, Ian, and good morning. And thank you to the Institute for two things. Firstly, the huge amount of work it's done and will no doubt continue to do in putting the information note together and helping prompt discussion and debate. And secondly, for the opportunity to come here today. So look, I prepared on the basis that I have 5 minutes to speak, which I think is about right. So look, I just want to run through, I guess, a few headline items. Firstly, just to very quickly touch on the survey that we did and what came out of that. Briefly about deferred acquisition costs and in particular the tax treatment. Talk a little about, make a very brief comment about early adoption and then a few comments about potential next steps and perhaps a couple of issues that arise. So most of you will probably be aware we did a survey, I think it was in September last year, covering 19 institutions, I believe, across all three insurance industries. My comments will pretty much refer predominantly to the general and life insurance industries. I think there was a fair bit of commonality in terms of the issues that people identified around treatment of reinsurance, the level of aggregation, the effect of the risk adjustment, the contract boundary, and the use of the simplified approach or the premium allocation approach versus the general measurement approach. And they seem to be pretty much the common themes that people highlighted as the major issues for them, I think roughly in that order. We did ask if anybody was in a position to provide us with any set of reasonable financial statements in AASB 17 format, and the answer to that was no. So that's probably not surprising, I suppose, but I guess one of the themes I'll come back to is that certainly for the work we would need to do, it is a little difficult to do anything until we have some sense of the impacts of AASB 17 on capital, obviously, in particular, before we can start working through what, if any, changes we'd need to make to our prudential requirements. And just on that, it's probably a question we often get asked in forums is, you agree, don't you, APRA, that it's as far as possible desirable to use the accounting treatment as the basis for prudential treatment? I think it's a very broad and general comment. We would agree with that. However, we just don't know yet the extent to which that may need to be modified. That's certainly something we see across all industries at the moment. No industry is perfectly aligned with its accounting standards in terms of our capital and prudential requirements. But as I said, as a principle, it sounds reasonable, and we'll certainly start with that sort of lens as we start working through the issues. Tax treatment of DAC, of course, is a big issue for life insurers, which is the industry closest to my heart. And we, and indeed Treasury and the ATO, are well aware of the issues and questions that, that people are asking there. In fact, even in a conversation just before we started today, just talking about the clarification around the current position, which is that when our prudential standards commenced largely in their current, or significantly in a lot of their current form back in the early 2000s, and the tax treatment was aligned around that as well, also around the accounting and tax basis that the government proposed. The tax treatment was aligned with the prudential requirements as a government policy decision. It wasn't APRA's decision, and while we acknowledge that our approach to prudential matters may have some influence on that, it's predominantly a tax and policy decision. We're talking to both Treasury and the ATO about that, and we'll continue to do so. And I guess all three parties have agreed that at this stage there's been no decisions either explicitly or implicitly made around what the future tax treatment would be. I guess the key thing to note is when the current arrangements came into place in 2000, the transition to that new arrangement took place over, I think, 5 years. And I imagine it wouldn't be unreasonable to expect that if there's a change to the tax treatment for DAC as a result of ASB 17, it might come in over a similar sort of period of time. The notion that there will be some windfall effect for anybody, I think, if that's the basis for your planning, you probably need to have a plan B as well. Just touching on early adoption, I think the broad statement is that very few entities have indicated to us that they're considering early adoption, and there's probably less of them today than there were 6 months ago. And it's, so it's an even smaller number than it was. I guess our key message on that front is that if you are considering early adoption, please talk to us as soon as possible. Ian mentioned it'd be helpful to make some comments about the sort of the timing and the implications of what we're going to be doing. So as I talk about next steps, it's probably important to say that there is a possibility, and it's nothing more than that at this stage, that there will be some requirement for dual reporting for a period. We just don't know yet. We look at the fact there are still many issues of interpretation to be clarified, and also the fact that the timetable, when you look at it objectively in light of all the things that we currently know, isn't all that long. It's not that far away. And as we started to work backwards to try and work out when we need to make determinations, the timetable is fairly short. So, as I said, there is a possibility there'll be some dual reporting for some period of time. That's obviously more work for us as well as for the industries. So it's not something we would certainly plan for in terms of a desirable outcome, but it's certainly a possibility. So I guess the next key steps for us are we'll shortly communicate formally the results of the survey, although I've already talked to quite a few industry groups and bodies around what we've seen, which is what I mentioned earlier. We will do a follow-up information gathering later in 2018. Hopefully by that stage we'll be able to start getting some numbers, even if they're on a very pro forma basis, even if everything hasn't been resolved to that point. We'll monitor clarification of the many issues that need to be clarified and interpreted, and keeping a register of the issues. We also are getting close to, if you like, having a list of the things that we need to work through and to start thinking about when that might occur. There are numerous ways in which we can engage with industry. We certainly want to do that. At the moment, I guess one of the challenges has been there's almost too many different bodies looking at this issue, but we realise that's because of the complexity. But certainly we intend to talk to industry and go through a good consultation process prior to making any final decisions. We're also talking to our peer regulators around the world. Many of them seem to be in a similar position to us in that the lack of clarification and interpretation issues is still challenging for them. And we haven't heard of any institution that's been able to present a credible set of financial statements in the new format. So we'll keep talking to our peer regulators, particularly in the major jurisdictions, and keep a track of what they're doing. And you know, if we can learn from things that they're doing that will make our task easier and end up with a better outcome for everybody, we'll certainly do that. I'll finish there, Ian. Thank you.
Very good. Just take a chair
there. Okay, I failed my first test as an MC for today because I've got the order wrong on the agenda and I forgot to introduce Adrian. But so let me start with Adrian. Just for those that don't know, because I know him very well. Adrian is a general manager in the supervision area of APRA, and he in particular chairs the life insurance industry group within APRA. So many of you will have met him in a supervisory capacity, For those that haven't, he knows what he's talking about. Janry, we'll have you next, then we'll ask for some questions, and then I'll go back to the agenda. Janry, over to you, please. Sorry, I need to introduce Janry, don't I? You come over here. So Janry is from the AASB. She's a senior project manager. Her responsibilities include various standard-setting projects and assisting the technical director with management of technical staff. She's involved in various international projects and so on. So, Janry, over to you.
Thank you, Ian. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, the Institute of Actuaries, for giving us a few minutes. Firstly, I'd just like to say thank you very, very much to the efforts of the task force and the TRG under leadership of Anne, for everything that you do and the work that you put in to make this standard real and to work through everything. The effort, the complexity, and all your hard work, it is noticed. And we as the standard setter, we do appreciate it, because we can set standards and we can advise. But ultimately, it's you who have to go out and prepare those financial standards. So just thank you, and please just remember, any help or assistance we can provide, please don't ever hesitate to pick up the phone. So just a few thoughts and remarks from our side. Yes, for us, as the standard setter, it's a new world, AASB 17. It's a whole new beast that lies ahead. So for us, the main thing is IFRS compliance. So we don't, when we talk to our international peers, just like Adrian mentioned, when we talk to them to hear what's happening on the international front, IFRS compliance is first and foremost. So whenever we receive something AASB 17 related, we'll first think, all right, will this taint or impact our compliance in any way before we take it further? And we need to keep in mind, in Australia, we're quite in a unique position, because we have already operational working insurance standards that many other jurisdictions don't have. So there is that, or there may be that temptation to go take this, make it our own, and run ahead. Now, we know that's what we do, and we should do that, because we do have that knowledge and experience that we should draw on. But all I'm saying is we just should err on the cautious side, or we should just make sure that we are on the cautious side and not go and interpret something that might impact our IFRS compliance and our international credibility. And the people on our TRG, whenever they submitted questions or so, they will see the input that we give is always to just make sure, is there anything that may have an impact? IFRS compliance, are we good? Have we put it or articulated in the best possible way to put forward our thought processes, so that the international community understand what we mean and is very likely to give us, or more likely to give us, an outcome that we want? That is our role. The other thing about the TRG, and I know Anne will talk about it in more detail, is just also keep in mind that the TRG, its main purpose is not to give or formulate interpretations of this standard. It's more to get different views and bringing it together and establish a forum to discuss that can ultimately go up to the International Standards Board. So we get a lot of questions about what will the TRG say, will they interpret this or that? So I just wanted to clarify that. Now, that is the TRG. I've explained our process or our involvement in this process. The only other comment I wanted to make is it's also important that we, as an insurance community, keep talking to our international counterparts. Just like the regulators reaching out to their counterparts offshore, I know Ian and his team have been liaising with some of their colleagues in the International Actuarial Association, and we are doing the same on the accounting side. So we have put forward the information note to the International Accounting Standards Board. They definitely wanted to have a look at it. They will provide feedback in the form of informal comments. So it will not be endorsed as such, but it will mainly be, all right, we don't see anything that may cause problems later on also. So yes, that's happening on the standard setting side. And I'm sure you will talk more about the TRG, but if you have any questions or need any assistance, please do not hesitate to reach out to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Janri. So we'll open it up to questions. We've got a couple of minutes, and then we'll move on to the where we should have been on the agenda. So any questions? While you've got APRA sitting up here, there's a great opportunity to put them on the spot. Yes? So Anne can ask a question. There's a microphone coming.
Thanks. Just a quick question for Janri. How much discussion on an ongoing basis is there between the Australian Accounting Standards Board and the other accounting standards boards overseas?
Yes, so we are quite involved in those discussions. There's definitely the Global Coordination Group calls that we attend with other standard setters in Asia and Europe. I myself have regular catch-ups with the project managers on the insurance project at the ISB. I'm actually travelling to London in 2 weeks' time, and we do have a meeting set up. We also make sure that we do link in with other standard setters like Canada, who are running their own TRG as well. So we just make sure that if there's news or anything like that, that we do jump in and we talk. And obviously, if there's anything of note, then we make sure to feed it through the various channels.
Any other questions? Yes. Microphone coming.
Hi. To what extent has the standard been adopted around the world? Now, what major countries, and I think there's the US, but maybe what other countries are there who are not going to adopt the standard?
So all IFRS reporters or countries that apply IFRS, they have to adopt this standard. But obviously everyone appreciates the work and preparation that need to go into it. So that's why we have an effective date so long into the future. So all I can say is it's a global phenomenon. All IFRS reporters that we talk to in our forums, they are preparing for it. In Asia, everyone is preparing for it. I know early in May, there's a big workshop in Malaysia focusing on Asia. Obviously, the US, they apply US GAAP, so the standard is not applicable there, but there might be companies filing on the SEC that are IFRS reporters or consolidate up into an IFRS parent company. They will all have to apply it. So it's a global thing. One thing that I can share is that I do know that Australia, in terms of implementation and preparation, we are quite far ahead in the process compared to some of our other counterparts or of our colleagues offshore. I've answered your question.
Okay, another minute or two for questions from me. Yes, Brett?
Question for Adrian. Many companies have taken the opportunity to do a finance transformation on the back of IFRS. To what extent is APRA considering doing a capital innovation or review on the back of IFRS?
Yeah, look, I think the general position is we're not at this stage planning to use ASB 17 as a rationale for reviewing a whole bunch of stuff. We're comfortable with the current prudential settings in broad terms. There might be some issues, but they're not related really to ASB 17. So short answer is we're not.
Okay, one last question.
Yep.
Scott.
A question for Adrian, probably. The GI issues are very different to the life issues with Interaction to Life Act, so just some colour around how you may or may not have a dual track around how you deal with the capital that flows from, or your prudential requirements that flow from that.
Yeah, the review of our prudential requirements as a result of ASB 17 is being handled by one oversight group, so we'll have different streams within that. So we'll have relevant... We've got accounting experts, we'll have actuarial people with the appropriate background to deal with those. So we intend as far as possible to do all of them in parallel. And yeah, we acknowledge that the issues in the GI space don't seem to be as significant as the life space at this stage at least. So does that answer your question?
it does. Exactly that. Just around, I could see a situation where the complexity in life, I mean, the Life Act interaction and changes may mean that has a secondary timetable compared to perhaps enforcing some prudential standards in the GI space.
Yeah, well, at this stage, we probably haven't got to that level of detail. That may be an outcome. I guess we'd, as far as possible, like to come out with them at the same time if we can, but that's something we'll need to think through as we get into the detail.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm a little disappointed you didn't give Adrian more of a hard time, but, you know. Thanks very much, guys. Okay, so we'll now go backwards a little bit, and I'll introduce Brendan and Anne. So, Brendan and Anne, you might just come up here, and I know you're going to do a bit of a tag team exercise. So, Anne, first of all, has worked in the Australian general insurance industry for more than 25 years, so she's got lots of experience. She's been in audit and advisory roles. She's worked in the UK general insurance industry as an auditor, and she's currently Group Head of Finance, Policy and Assurance at QBE. So she has direct responsibility for the implementation of IFRS 17 for QBE globally, and that covers 36 countries. So she's deeply involved in it. She also, until recently, was the chair of the AALC. She's a member of our task force, and she's been a really helpful contributor. And she's an accountant rather than an actuary, of course. Brendan, on the other hand, is an actuary and not an accountant. And he works for EY's actuarial practice, specialising in the life insurance sector. He's a member of EY's global IFRS 17 technical panel and contributes to a number of local industry and professional groups on that standard. So over to you. I think, Anne, you're going to talk first.
Thank you, Ian. This works. How do I make this move?
The little thing on the...
Oh.
And it's probably better to watch the left-hand screen. The right-hand screen's not working properly.
Okay. I don't think the left-hand screen's working either. I'll just keep looking up here.
Okay.
All right, thank you. So where do I start? Well, I think you mentioned before, Ian, this is an accounting standard, so I'm an accountant. I know there are a few others in here. One of the important things, I think, going forward with this standard is recognising it. It's an accounting standard, but it takes accountants and actuaries working together to make this thing real and putting it into practice as a preparer. I'm very well aware of that. First, a shout out to the Institute of Actuaries and the Task Force. They have done an enormous amount of work. I could only echo Yanri's comments earlier. A huge amount of work has gone into preparing this document. This is the first from one of the jurisdictions applying IFRS to come out. So that's great work. I think the other thank you I'd like to say to the task force is thank you for involving the accountants in this, because this has been an interesting journey. We've managed to get some accounting input into the development of the information note, which I think has been very important. I keep saying you've got to make sure we can still understand it as you go forward. So that's been good. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about the forums that that I'm involved in that are currently up and running in relation to supporting IFRS 17 or ASB 17 as it is to us here. I'm currently sitting on the International Accounting Standards Board, TRG. So I'll tell you a bit about that. I'm also chairing the Australian Accounting Standards Board, TRG, which is what Yanri mentioned earlier. And last year I was chairing the ALC, which is the Accountants and Actuaries Liaison Committee, which actually is playing a very good role in a standard like this where you need to bring actuaries and accountants together. Scott Hadfield, where is he, Scott, is the current chair this year. And we'll be continuing the good work. And the final thing I wanted to touch on was the current areas of focus, the areas of debate that we're dealing with in both the international TRG and the Australian TRG. And then, Brendan, I'm going to hand over to Brendan, who wants to talk you through an example of an area of interpretation that we're working on, just to illustrate some of the difficulties that we face trying to make this a very international standard. So the International Accounting Standards Board, TRG, was set up last year. We've had a meeting in February, an admin meeting in November, and the next one is in May. There are four locked in for this year. So the International Accounting Standards Board set the TRG up as part of their implementation support of IFRS 17. So it's in many ways, it's a kind of part of their training and education. The things that come out of this TRG really are the three options. One is more education support or webinars that can come from the ISB. They can actually refer issues up to the Interpretations Committee. And actually, ultimately, they could refer things to the International Accounting Standards Board for changes to the standard. So they're the three options that really will come out of this TRG. So who's on the TRG? Well, there are 15 members. There are the six big audit firms are on there. We've also got nine preparers, and they are selected internationally. I'm the representative from Australia. There's a Canadian representative, a few from Europe and the UK, and a few from Asia. So nine in all. I've listed them up here just in case you're interested. There are also board members from the ISB, so there's Sue Lloyd, who might be familiar to people here because she used to be on the Australian Accounting Standards Board years ago, but she's now the vice chair of the International Accounting Standards Board. So she's on the TRG, as well as Daryl Scott and the chair, who's Martin Edelman. Also, there are a few international observers, and I think one of them up here is the International Association of Insurance Supervisors, who would have a direct line to APRA, I'm sure. There are also three observers on the panel, plus five or six of the ISB staff, and anyone can have a fun day out by coming to watch us as well. It's open to the public. So if you're feeling like a trip to London and a day out, there we are. It's also webcast live. So I know, is Grant Robinson here? I think he managed to sit through about four or five of the last webcasts, which would have gone through the night here in Australia. But they are then available in subsequently on the ISB's website. So anytime you want, you can go back and get some, you know, good soap opera TV. So what are we talking about? Well, the things that we're talking about are issues that are put to the ISB TRG. So it's only as good as the questions that are raised to it. And there is no, there is a format, and you have to have relevant questions to the TRG, but it's open to anyone to put those questions forward. And there were about seven papers debated last time. And they're on the ISB's website. We actually, you know, you go in with an Australian perspective, and it's very interesting to see the more international perspective. And this is the world that we're working in now, is the interpretation world. We might see it one way, but of course in Europe or in Asia, they're looking at these same, potentially same products or very similar products in a very different way. And so that's what it's about, is trying to get these issues on the table and try and come to some sort of agreement or consensus. And also the focus being on how will you apply this in practice. So it's written down, it's all words, how do you take this and apply it in practice? This is actually where it's really helpful, having something like the information note as well from Australia. Although I have to say, and we were talking about this earlier, Ian, you'd expect a few iterations as the interpretations get discussed. So let me just talk briefly about the timeline, because this is quite important. I put this up, you know, if we're looking at the companies and the preparers on the bottom, to the point I think you made, Adrian, there's not a long time to go to 1/1/21 when you work backwards, the fact you've got to have comparatives for the year before. You've got to get your investors, you've got to get your, you know, your budgeting and planning, as well as your actual reporting on the right basis. So timeline working backwards means we haven't got an awful lot of time to go. But the timeline on the top shows you the ISB's TRG timeline. They're expecting the meetings to go full through 18. And actually, there's an indication that they'll be going through until mid 2019. So if you're expecting changes to come out of that, it's going to be quite late in that preparation piece, in that timeline, that we're actually going to be seeing the changes. And that's obviously a major concern for preparers, is how do you actually go forward when you know things could change? So let me just talk briefly about the ASB's TRG. So the IFRS 17 came out in May last year. I think Australia was the first adopter to pick this up as ASB 17 for the for-profit entities in July last year. By November, by October, we had the ASB's TRG set up. And because of my role on the international TRG, I got to chair the ASB's TRG. It's quite a different setup, and I've got a slide which covers who's on there. But broadly speaking, it's roughly 30 people representing preparers, auditors, Treasury departments, all our corporate and capital regulators, the ATO, and the not-for-profit sector as well. So it's quite a big committee that we're operating. It meets, it has a dual purpose. One is to take the papers that are presented to the ISB's TRG and to debate them in the Australian environment and see if we have any specific jurisdictional issues or any concerns with the papers or the outcomes that they may represent. That allows me to take a broader industry view back to the International Accounting Standards Board, TRG. Now, I've been selected there as a general insurer, but there's nothing to stop me actually presenting that broader perspective. And I know that thank you to the actuaries have been teaching me life insurance, actuaries and accountants, in fact. So, yes, a fast learning curve. We are using that opportunity that we have of me being on the International Accounting Standards Board, TRG, to try and present some Australia-wide views. But the other objective of the Australian TRG is to deal with the local issues and the issues that we might see here that we actually want to put forward to the ISB's TRG, or we might be able to resolve ourselves. We've had two papers being issued so far. One was from the ICA, the Insurance Council of Australia, and that was, although it was from a group of general insurers, it has been reviewed by the broader group, so of life insurers and health insurers as well. So that was quite good to get that one up. And that's it missed the February discussions, but it will be on the table for the May discussions. And another paper has just recently gone up as one on, which actually Brendan's going to talk about, but it's around contract boundary. So I'll leave Brendan to tell you more about that. Other things that probably important to pick up, just a quick flick to the ASB TRG. I mentioned it's quite broad, so I've grouped people there, but I don't need to spend any time on that. The ASB's TRG has a specific mandate about who it needs to include when they set up TRG, so that's why it's quite a broad group. But again, like the ISB TRG, it's open to the public. So if you feel like a grand day out, the dates and the times are on the ASB's website. Don't hesitate to dial in or to come along. We try and make sure there's a place in Melbourne and in Sydney. And sorry for those that don't live there, but they're the two biggest hubs that we have. But we also try to be very transparent in our ASB TRG in a way that probably the ISB is less so. We're making sure that where we've got papers that we're trying to share them so that the broader Australian industry can have a look at what we're talking about and why we think the way we think. Okay. This is just a quick flick through some of the topics that we're dealing with now. In the box, the dotted line, are the things that I think will be coming up next. So the ones outside are the ones that are currently on the table to be discussed. The first couple are very big in the world of accountants, and they will matter to you, but certainly balance sheet disclosure. So the financial statements and the way that the balance sheet is disclosed is driving a significant cost impost, but with very little value-add information that we're getting out of that. So that's been top of the issues list for many, not just general insurers, although it's very, very heavily cost-based for general insurers, but it's actually also concerning the life insurers and health insurers as well. Premiums received is a specific topic. If you want to know more about that, look at the ASB's website. There's a paper on, two papers, I think, on that there. Other issues that we're talking about are coverage units, so that's how profit emerges over the boundary of the contract. So very key for preparers, for investors, anyone who's interested in what this is going to do to insurers' financial statements and results. There are other topics around acquired portfolios, which have come as a bit more of an interest and surprise. And again, there's papers on the ASB's website if you want to know more about that. And the other big topic du jour is contract boundary, which, as I said, Brendan's going to touch on. If I was to look forward to the sort of topics that we're seeing come up, reinsurance is top of my list. That one, I just don't think the standard has nailed that, and I think there's work that needs to be done on that. And I'm hoping that we can really focus on that, probably not for the May TRG, but really for September. And there will be, I'm sure as we go through, there'll be many other issues that come up. But they're the ones I wanted to highlight. I would just point out that we are not doing this in isolation. I mean, Australia, as I see, has a great opportunity to help with the interpretation of this standard. And that's because we're used to having accounting standards, we're used to having actuaries and accountants talk together. We've got a number of forums like these, the ASB TRG, like the task force, and like the ALC that I mentioned, where we can actually start to debate and resolve issues quite quickly with the right people in the room. So I think we've got a lot that we can bring to the international stage. But it is interesting working through and realising when you get into the ISB's TRG how different the perspectives are from the different preparers in different countries. So we've got a lot of work to do. So on that note, I will hand over to Brendan, who will talk to you a bit more about his favourite topic.
Thanks, Anne. So I just was going to talk for a few minutes on some of the specific work that we're doing on the TRG. On that previous slide, there were four topics there, I think, that had a star on them. So those are topics that we've put papers into the IASB's TRG already. So you can go onto the IASB website and find those papers just to give you a sense of where we're going on those topics. I think some of the other topics that Anne had on her other slide, sort of for the future, certainly reinsurance is a big one. And a few of the others listed there, I guess I'm hoping we'll be able to resolve in the Australian industry, not necessarily taking every single one of those topics to the ISB, but we'll see how we go. So I wanted to talk to you just briefly about the challenges that we have with interpretation and why it can be difficult at times, and I'll talk a bit about the contract boundary as a specific example of that in a moment. But I guess the standard is an international standard, and I often get asked this question, why can't I just have the answer? So, Brendan, can you just tell me what's the answer? Is it A or B? Just tell me the answer. Unfortunately, that's difficult, and it can sometimes be a bit of a slow and frustrating process. I understand that. I guess we're lucky here in Australia, as Yanri mentioned, that we do have some pretty good accounting standards already. Others around the world aren't in that position. So when we start, often we're starting from our local accounting standards, and we're often starting from outcomes and viewing things in a way that we're used to, and the outcomes that we're used to seeing across the way that we manage our business in respect of the current accounting standards for Australia. So that's fine. However, that can result in a diversity of views, right? So now that we've got an accounting standard that relates to all different industries, so we've got health insurance, life insurance, general insurance in there, and different people from those industries, different entities coming from a different perspective, starting with the outcomes that they're possibly used to, we can get a wide divergence in views. So that tends to slow the process, and it can tend to lead to sort of a lack of industry-wide consensus. The other thing worth mentioning is the IASB has had quite a long consultation period on this, and that's possibly been counterproductive in some senses. So, for example, you know, before the standard was released in 2017, we had probably a year or two of discussion on the variable fee approach, mirroring, whatever you want to call it, for participating business. And so a lot of the general insurers kind of disengaged at that point, right? So because the focus was on areas that weren't relevant for them. So that also possibly hasn't helped, hopefully the ISB's TRG will help with some of those issues. So that said, I guess the key message there, the ISB is pretty reluctant to make substantial changes now that the standard is out. The other point to mention is it's a principles-based standard. The ISB doesn't interpret the standard. So someone asked me actually the other week, can I just have a piece of paper with the interpretation written on it for a particular issue? Well, so the ISB does have a committee called IFRIC, which does do interpretations. But just to give you a sense, on the previous slide we had 13 broad issues that we were looking at for interpretation. Each of these has many subcomponents that require interpretation. To give you an example, on the reinsurance topic, a couple of weeks ago, someone sent me a 24-page document with 13 interpretive questions just on reinsurance. I had a look at that list, compared that to my list, and I reckon the author missed a few. So reinsurance is possibly one of the more, if not most, complex issues, but just gives you a sense of the complexity here. So key point, many interpretations required on IFRS 17. We've got IFRIC, but if I have a quick scan of IFRIC's website, I can see there are 23 bits of paper published with interpretations on them since 2004 across all accounting standards. Okay, that's 17 IFRSs and 41 IASs, so 58 accounting standards. We've had 23 interpretations since 2004. So compare that to the many, many interpretations we're going to require just for this standard. So that gives you a sense of why this is challenging, right? So I think best approach, you know, as we're doing, stay abreast of the industry developments, so, you know, you're not out on a limb as an organisation. Bring questions to the task force, to the TRG, and to other industry groups. That's what they're there for, and we'll help to get them resolved as best we can.
Brendan, I'm going to hurry you up a little bit, please.
Okay. Okay, so very quickly on contract boundaries. So this is the issue with YRT. Is it short duration or long duration? And this just gives you a sense of the process. So we've had many arguments supporting both sides. We've put in a paper that boils it down to four different interpretive issues, and we've tried to put a view on each based on the wording of the standard. Okay, so just trying to take a step-back approach, not focused on any particular outcomes for any particular products. The paper then summarises the key points and then applies them to specific fact patterns. So that's a bit of ISB jargon, which means, okay, now you've got a view on a particular interpretation, apply it to a particular product or set of facts and work out the outcome. So I think that's the approach that the ISB, it works with the ISB, the ANRI and the AASB have been very helpful in just positioning that paper in such a way that the ISB is going to, this is going to be useful for the ISB and will hopefully get us an answer. So that paper is available up on the website for anyone that is interested. Finally, I'll just talk very quickly about the International Actuarial Association. So a couple of things there. So the IAA has issued an international standard of actuarial practice. So that's a principles-based standard that's pretty short. It's draft, so they're looking for feedback. It's about 9 pages. And they are seeking comment on that by 30th of June, which we will provide. So that's a, as I said, short principles-based document. The larger document that the IAA is also working on is this one. So this is the International Actuarial Note, which is a lot more detailed and has more pragmatic, practical guidance in it. So that one is 130 pages compared to our 182-page document. However, it is missing 4 chapters at the moment, and one of them's CSM, so expect that one to expand, I think. So the IA is also looking for feedback on that by the 18th of May, which the task force will provide, but if anyone is interested in receiving a copy of that document, please let me or anyone else on the task force know, and we're happy to take feedback on that document as well. Thank you.
We are running behind, but I'll give you an opportunity to ask one or two quick questions of Brendan or Anne. Any questions, pressing issues? Stuart.
It's just a quick question. You said for-profit and, of course, not-for-profit covered, but I've heard that government insurers may be having a variation of the standard. Is that true, and is there a timing for that?
There is a discussion paper out at the moment. Sorry, there is a discussion paper that the ASB put out last year. I'm looking at Nianri here just to confirm that. And that is for public sector entities and for not-for-profits. So that, Yanri, I'm not sure what the date for feedback is on that. Can you elaborate?
Thank you. The comment period has closed at the end of February, but if someone still would like to comment, well, we will read their comment later.
And is that just for Australia, or is it internationally the case that government insurers?
That is an Australian discussion paper, just for not-for-profit and public sector entities in Australia issuing insurance-like contracts.
Any more questions? Going on. Okay, thanks very much, Christopher. All right, so we're now moving on to core requirements, and Francis Beans is going to talk to us about certain components of that core requirements section of the IN. So Francis is an actuary with Finity Consulting. He's got 12 years' experience in general insurance, has consulted to general insurers and accident compensation schemes. He's currently a member of the task force, and importantly is the liaison between that task force and the GIPC. So, Francis, over to you.
Thanks, Ian. This is where we get really interactive. This is where there'll be lots of discussion and questions. Some of them will be from me to you. If we have lots of interaction, then Ian's going to have to cut us short because we could speak for hours on some of these topics. If we don't have a huge amount of interaction, we'll probably step through reasonably quickly. I've got about five slides, and then I'll hand over to the next person. So you'll see slides like this pop up for the key areas that we're going to discuss. And at the kind of very opening, here are the questions. The topics that I'm covering is aggregation, contract boundary, modification, and a tiny bit on derecognition. The guidance or the information note has two chapters on those, chapter 2, which is on aggregation and contract boundary, and then chapter 10, which is on modification and derecognition. So straight off the bat, I've got these questions, and then we'll go into a bit more detail into contract boundary and aggregation. So does anybody have comments initially on the readability, the sufficiency of detail, and the interaction between the information note and the accounting standard? Not yet. I'll take that as an indication we're just warming up, and we'll go into more detail, and then we'll have plenty of opportunity for questions there as well. So we'll start with aggregation, portfolios and groups. Why does it matter? So portfolios matter because portfolios are the level at which AASB requires segmentation of the business. It's defined in the standard as insurance contracts that are subject to similar risks and managed together. AASB 17 doesn't define what either of those things mean. So our information note has then provided a little bit of guidance. And if you're following through, I'm just going to touch on a couple of little bits in the information note. But questions 2.6 and 2.7 have a bit of guidance there. So similar risks, it doesn't mean identical. So this is question 2.6. Similar risks are not identical risks, so you would expect some variation in risk. Since insurance is diverse and all portfolios are different, there's no prescriptive guidance, but we'd expect there to be some level of consistency in grouping product lines that already exists within insurance companies, and that probably provides a good starting point for thinking about what similar risks means under AASB 17. Once you have similar risks, they then need to be managed together. And once again, this is sort of similar to the similar risks concepts. not specifically defined. It will require a level of granularity in assignment of portfolios. Probably it works quite well with managed together. Sorry, that similar risks and managed together probably work quite well together. This involves ways in which the business is managed. So if you have a look at internal management reporting systems, that will straight away give you an idea about what managed together means currently within an insurer. But other factors that could be relevant when thinking about whether insurance contracts are managed together could include distribution channels, the level at which regulation takes place. For example, CTP insurance is a regulated product, and so that is likely to be managed together. The basis used for allocating capital, and the operating model or management structure of the entity. The information note then has a little bit more information about multi-peril and multi-benefit products in question 2.8. It has a little bit of guidance on separating risks. So if you have a contract and you want to be able to disaggregate it, there's some guidance there. Once you've answered all those questions, you'll then come up with portfolios. And then within each portfolio, we further segment into groups. And this is where onerous contracts play a part. So Grant's going to talk a little bit about onerous contracts in the next session, but onerous contracts are also relevant to the definition of portfolio and aggregation. So each portfolio is going to be split into three groups, one of which is onerous, one of which is contracts that are definitely not onerous, and one of which is we're not really sure. So it's currently not onerous, but there's a reasonable there's some possibility that it would become onerous later on. How do you allocate contracts within a portfolio to the groups? We have some guidance in question 2.15, which says, quite importantly, individual contract assignment might be possible, but is not necessarily required and wouldn't typically be something that insurers would do. We normally expect them to choose a more aggregate level, which could be based on elements such as differentiation of risk and pricing. The standard talks about using reasonable and supportable information, and the objective of assigning contracts to the categories can be achieved by assessing a set of contracts. If the entity can conclude using reasonable and supportable information that the contracts in the set will all be in the same group. If you're using the premium allocation approach, there's a slightly different definition. You don't have to split it into the three groups. You can just split it into, you treat everything as not onerous unless facts and circumstances suggest that some of the contracts would be onerous. All right, that's my Cook's tour of the information note. So then we move on to questions. So I said the first question, is your company or client expecting that you will be involved in setting portfolio definitions? So I suppose we've got a range of actuaries and accountants in the room, and I fully expect that lots of the accountants will be involved. I guess this is a question more for the actuaries in the room. Have you had discussions with your companies or clients at this stage? And if yes, is there an expectation that you're going to be involved in setting portfolios? Hands up for yes. I'd say it's quite a few. And I assume, is everybody else no? Well, hands up for no, where a company has explicitly said actuaries are not involved, this is just going to be accountants. No, no. So everyone else is unsure or hasn't had a discussion. Yeah. I suppose for those who are going to be involved or expecting to be involved, have you started doing it yet? So have you considered your portfolio in light of the accounting standard and in light of the information note that we've put out? Hands up for yes. A couple, fantastic, that's very exciting. For those who have, do you have any comments or questions about the information note or about the process of assigning contracts to portfolios and then possibly into groups? Put your hand up if you do. No? Okay. I suppose then just a general question. And in addition to having questions today, you're most welcome to email through questions as well or comments as well on the guidance note. But you know, the other questions that we're interested in is, does the information note provide enough information to help with assigning contracts to portfolios? Do you, within your company, have enough information to assign contracts to portfolios? Do we need any additional guidance on what's required there or what's not required there? Any issues with particular products or type of insurance, and would any further guidance on this topic compared to what we've got in the information note be helpful? So if there's no questions there, we'll then move on to contract boundary. So briefly, what is it? Why do we care? Why does it matter? So firstly, the length of the contract or the contract boundary is an important factor in determining PAA eligibility. If the contract boundary is up to 12 months, you can use the premium allocation approach. If the contract boundary is longer than 12 months, you can only use the premium allocation approach if additional criteria are met. And I won't go into those criteria because we've got a separate session on PAA later. Secondly, it determines which cash flows are included in the liability for remaining coverage calculations. So if your contract boundary is 12 months, then you only look at cash flows related to the next 12 months when you're doing your calculations. If your contract boundary is 5 years, then you're going to be including cash flows for the full 5 years in those calculations. There is still some uncertainty here. As Brendan was mentioning, this is one of the key questions that is with the transition resource group, particularly around yearly renewable term insurance, but the similar questions apply to CTP or health insurance. And our guidance, our information note will, our information note will continue to be updated to reflect those discussions over, you know, months and years. So let's do another show of hands. Who, for the products that they currently have, thinks that contract boundary is very clear? You know it's definitely less than 12 months or it's definitely more than 12 months. Or who has some products like that? Everyone must have some. And who has some products where it's not clear, where you're not really sure if it's more or less than 12 months? All right, so there's quite a few people. So hopefully that means that the information note will form, will be useful in this area. So within the information note, question 2.23 has a flowchart to think about the contract boundary decision points. Unfortunately, it's a little bit fuzzy in the slides, but it's nice and clear in the actual information note. So if you haven't yet had a look, grab a copy of the information note and have a look at question 2.23, where you can see in crystal clarity the decision points for contract boundary. So the questions that you need to answer when thinking about contract boundary really come to what's the term of the contract and over what period can the insurer enforce premium payment, for example, or could the policyholder enforce that an insured event would be covered? With 12-month contracts, it's home and motor, for example, in Australia, general insurance home and motor products, they are 12-month contracts, and at the end of 12 months, you renew or you choose not to renew. The insurer can't force you to pay a premium beyond 12 months. And similarly, if you choose not to renew, you know, you can't enforce a renewal for those. There will be some products, so I'm familiar with general insurance, so lenders mortgage insurance, for example, you pay a premium up front and it covers you for multiple years. So that is providing benefits to the policyholder for more than 12 months. It will be a multi-year contract.
Francis, can I just pose a question there?
Yep.
This has come from somebody on the webinar. They're talking about the bottom left-hand bubble here. And the question is, shouldn't the bottom left balloon be boundary ends when contract ceases, as per the start of AASB 1734? If can compel payment of premium, then other contract boundary considerations not required. So that's the point. That's the question that's been posed.
And I must admit, I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. Is there anyone else on the task force who wants to jump in at this point? And if not, we'll take it on notice, and it's something that we can look at in detail. I'll take that as a, we'll take it on notice, and but thank you for the question. So the things that you kind of look at when you're having a look at contract boundary is, critically, can you reassess the risk to, sorry, the risks of the policyholder? Can you do that individually? And if not individually, can you do it within a portfolio or a number of contracts together? If you can do it within a portfolio, you then have to ask the question, can the entity set a price or level of benefits that fully reflects the risk of the portfolio? And if you can, you move on to, does the premium up to the reassessment date only include risks that relate to the period of coverage? So there's no premium for covered events beyond the reassessment date. And if so, your boundary ends at the reassessment date. So you can kind of say, well, this is where our boundary is. And for 12-month policies, that's going to be your 12-month period. If you answer no to those questions, then you're kind of jumping over to the left-hand box, which is going to be the boundary ends either at the date the entity cannot compel the policyholder or when the contract ceases, depending on what the answer to our question is. So any questions there? And maybe I'll ask some questions then. Does the information note appropriately guide you through assessing the contract boundary? Has anybody done this in practice and used the flow chart? Hands up for yes. Not yet? Maybe this afternoon after the workshop you could have a look through. And then would any further guidance be helpful? So for each of these blocks, there's often a question which the information note goes through in a bit of detail about what do some of these things mean. So I think after reading through the information note, if there's still areas of uncertainty, that's particularly what we'd like to know, if there's areas where we need to enhance the information note. Right. The next session then is, sorry, next chapter I'm going to briefly talk about is modification and derecognition. This is dealt with in chapter 10 of the information note. Sorry, I'm just going to shuffle my pages. Why does it matter? AASB 17 sets out a number of different requirements for how particular contract modifications are accounted for. So certain things are accounted for one way, other modifications are accounted for a different way. So depending on what's being modified and how, you need to account for it in a different way. So in question 10.1 of the information note, we have a flowchart, and that's the flowchart on the slide, that briefly goes through how you decide that. So firstly, is there a change in the contract? If not, the answer is easy. There's no contract modification. If there is a change in the contract, you have to ask yourself, is it due to the exercise of contractual rights? If you've written a contract where the insurer can adjust the terms and that's written into the contract, then that's not a modification of the contract. That's an exercise of contractual rights. And the cash flows that you're valuing should already allow for some probability weight of the different outcomes. If it's not a change due to the exercise of contractual rights, then it's going to be a contract modification, which is defined as a change in the legally enforceable terms of the contract, for example, either by agreement between the parties to the contract or by change in law or regulation. So if that's what happens, if there's been a change in the law, so let's say you write CTP policies and the New South Wales government changes the rules around CTP, so it provides a different level of benefits. And that happens on the 1st of December 2017 and you've already written contracts. Then that is a change in law or regulation and I think is likely to be a contract modification. There are two different types and the accounting for it depends on what type it is. It's either a paragraph 72 modification or it's not a paragraph 72 modification. Question 10.6 7 then talks about what is a paragraph 72 modification. And it's essentially, it's a really big change. So the specified criteria are things like, if the contract had been written at inception as modified, it would not have been classed as an insurance contract. So if something's happened and this is no longer an insurance contract, that's a paragraph 72 modification. If it would have been included in a different group, so if instead of being onerous, it would have been definitely not onerous or vice versa. If it would have had a significantly different contract boundary, if it's turned from a 12-month policy to a 5-year policy. If different components would have been separated, resulting in different insurance contracts. If the PAA was, if it did originally qualify for the premium allocation approach but would no longer qualify because of the modification, then that would be a paragraph 72. And similarly with the VFA, if it now qualifies or ceases to qualify as an insurance contract with direct participation features. In that circumstance, then you need to de-recognise the initial contract and recognise a new contract from the date of modification. So they're really big changes to the contract. For everything else, let's say the benefits are going to be slightly bigger, but it's not going to change the level of onerousness or whether a contract is onerous or not. Then you treat it as a change in cash flow estimates. So you revise assumptions just like you do for other changes in your basis, but you don't de-recognise and recognise a new contract. So, quick questions. In the last few years, has your portfolio had contracts where there would have been a contract modification? Not necessarily a big one, but there's been some change which wasn't built into the insurance policy. It was either a change in law or regulation, or it was by mutual consent of the parties. Has anybody had those in the last few years? I reckon New South Wales CTP probably counts, but aside from New South Wales CTP changes, so probably not many. So that's helpful for us now, I suppose, in where we focus and where we spend our time in terms of the information note. This is a relatively technical area, and I given that this is not something that people have come across, I assume not many people have read through it in detail at this stage. But when you do, if you have to work through a contract modification, let us know your feedback and guidance. That's everything from me. Grant's going to jump in now. Did we want to do any questions first, Ian? Or?
Yeah, let's just take the opportunity, if there are any questions for Francis on any of those topics that he's covered. Yeah, over here, Duncan. So there's one over there, Duncan, and one there.
Thanks, Ian. Maybe just a process question. You asked a specific question, Francis, about one aspect of the information note. Do you want some of those questions to come forward today? If there's people in the audience with, you know, very specific points about detailed aspects of the information note, or would you rather save those in the interest of time?
So let me answer that more generally. So we don't have time to delve too deeply here, but you know, if there's a specific point of interpretation or something that you're really grappling with, it might be a benefit for everybody to understand it's an issue, then we can raise it. We may not necessarily answer it today. But the more we understand about what you're struggling with, the better the job we can do on the information note, I think, is the point.
Okay, well, on that basis, I will ask one. Yeah, thanks. Okay. So this goes back to contract boundary. And the question around what does practical ability mean? And I am struggling a little bit. I'll perhaps ask Anne and Brendan at a break exactly who then does make interpretations, because I think I heard TRG doesn't, and I also heard the ISB doesn't, and the other, that committee, rarely does. But this information note very clearly says practical ability, it's on page 27, is considered to relate to any contractual or other legal restriction. I'd like to challenge that. Firstly, I'm not sure who is doing the considering when it says is considered, and I think it's quite telling that the standard does not say contractual right. It's clearly used a different phrase. So I'm a little bit surprised at maybe how quickly and seemingly definitively we've landed on practical ability means effectively a legal or contractual right. I have raised that question in other forums, including the ALC. I know others sort of share, maybe some in this audience share that same uncertainty. So I might just hold it there.
Yeah, just hold it there. Is anybody else struggling with the same issue? So, yes, we have another questioner in a sec. But any other? Okay, so Duncan, we'll take it on notice. Let me just check with any other members of the task force. Does anybody want to respond quickly to what Duncan has said? Yep, Brennan, go.
Yeah, sorry, just quickly on that. So I mentioned the paper that's gone up to the TRG. That's one of the four questions that we've asked in that paper. So it's worth having a look at that. Fair to say that, so we discussed that at the AASB TRG, and I think that was one of the questions we couldn't get a consensus on, wasn't it? And so I know that doesn't help you, but it will, we're hoping, get on the agenda of the IASB's TRG in May, and that very question will be covered and discussed. There's also, if you have a look at the paper, in the appendix to the paper, some other examples from other accounting standards where the words practical ability are used. So that also will hopefully help frame that discussion at the IASB's TRG meeting.
That paper that you just referred to, I had a quick look at it the other day and I thought it was very good. How do people access that?
Yes, so it's on the AASB website. So I think, Yanri, if you just Google AASB Transition Resource Group, that should take you to the TRG website, and then I think it's under other materials or supporting materials or something like that. There's that plus a number of other papers, and the link was on that slide that I flashed up earlier as well.
Yes, thanks, Brendan. If you go onto the AASB's website, there's a link at the top. It says AASB board, and then within the next subset, there's about the board. And then under the project advisory panels, there's one specifically for the IFRS 17 TRG, and all the materials are there. If you struggle to find something, just email there's an email address, and we can help navigate you.
Thank you very much. So, other question over there?
Well, I think my question's pretty much redundant now, because my question was around sort of everything I've seen so far has been purely from a legal perspective. And if you take a step back and look at the principles-based nature of accounting standards and something like AASB 137, which talks about legal or constructive obligations, so it's about setting an expectation in the marketplace. That if, for example, the policyholder can walk away and the insurer, even though under the terms of the contract, can enforce sort of premiums going forward, that the insurer by practice will say fine. So there's a valid expectation in the market that either party, or well, at least the policyholder can walk away. So that's that taking a step back and looking at the principles-based approach, which goes beyond legal and it goes towards constructive obligations, and that's 137. And the whole focus here has been on legal, and that was my sort of question. So,
okay, all right. One last chance. Any further questions before I move on? No. Okay. Thanks, Francis.
Thank you.
Okay. Our next speaker is Grant Robinson. So this is just in time presentation because he's just got off a plane from New Zealand and arrived a couple of minutes ago. Unfortunately, we're running a few minutes late. Grant, so. Yeah, it worked really well. Now, this is a man who lives and breathes IFRS 17. He's been involved in the development of IFRS insurance standards since 2007, was convener of the Institute's International Accounting Standards Committee. He is currently in charge of AMP's IFRS 17 project and the various other areas where he's been involved in accounting standards. So welcome him back to the country and for his presentation. Grant, over to you.
I made justice a little bit higher. Thank you. The plane actually arrived half an hour early, but a Sydney airport wanted us to sit around for half an hour until they had the gate available. So basically, you just sort of might be just getting a worthwhile overview from the two chapters on this, two current estimates as I'm covering. and really CSM and onerous contract. Before I get into detail, broadly, does those chapters broadly work for people, the way they approach things in there? Is there any feedback people want to give on that now? Or we'll wait until we get into more of the detail? I mean, the important thing to us is we read stuff, but I know from my own experience, I write stuff with an understanding of where I've come from and the journey I've been on, and when you've not been on that journey, what is obvious to me is not necessarily obvious to the reader who hasn't been on that long journey. My other track I find is I sometimes read stuff in that's no longer there because it was in one stage the journey has dropped back out again, which is another nasty track. So important things, and one of the key things we tried to do, and I don't know if we've done it always well, is to where we've actually reached views and stuff, we try to make it clear so you've got a chance of actually saying, okay, this answer, kind of what parts of AASB 17 did it actually come out of? So you've got some idea of coming where we came from if you want to form your own view around it or take another view. And hopefully we've got all the key options you've got and the uncertainties around there clear as well. So core requirements in the current estimates really should be familiar actuarial ground. And in one sense, we've got a large bulk of the current estimates chapter is on that topic, but a large bulk when you actually read through just basically says, okay, given what ASB 17, a lot of cases, there isn't really much change in effect. If you're familiar with current estimates, you're familiar with how to do these things, you read through that and go, okay, I don't need to worry any further about these things. And that's kind of what a large chunk of that chapter is really about. But there are a few things that come up out of our fund topic, which part of which we just discover, which is around the contractual cash flows up to the contract boundary. That's quite a new nuance we're probably not used to. And depending on various debates on contract boundaries, do or don't land, and they're not just in the YRT space. There's an interesting one sitting in reinsurance too. And also that has a potential impact. So we've basically tried to highlight a few of them, and I hope they're clear. Like, loans on policies, if they're contractual right, which they are on conventional policies, your loan on policy, cash flows out to the client, cash flows back, all the margins, they're part of the measurement of that conventional policy liability. They're not a separate item on your balance sheet anymore, which is quite a significant change from our current word. In fact, when you actually read 1038, you kind of wonder, well, possibly they should have been anyway if we'd ever been thinking it in those terms. But that's what maybe did them. Profit shares. Basically, given there's no real policyholder view, profit shares, particularly if you've got group risk type business, they're a bit more problematical to think through. So we've got some chapters on that. And tax is an interesting one too. So people got any questions around any of those sort of areas? So they think basically current estimates is fairly well covered. And it's a nice long chapter, but basically you don't need to worry too much. And the writer we've done in there is expected values, which is one shift. It's not just the best estimate. In a lot of cases, that probably doesn't make a difference, but you probably do need to think through where that might actually make a difference to your answers. I know there's been a big discussion which comes up later in BFA-type business where you've got asymmetry, et cetera. Some people allowed for it after, some people allowed for it before. Now it's definitely inside your expected value if it's there. Yes? Peter?
One other issue on the current estimates is expenses. I'm wondering if there's been much discussion about expenses and what our insurance acquisition costs. Seems to be a big difference because currently we use like fully allocated costs in your policy liability. Now we're using whatever the term is, you know, direct costs.
Yeah. Right, we've meant to change. So there we are. Okay, it's not going the right way. But yeah, so basically expected value. So expenses is definitely one of the topics. We have sort of covered it in there. Some people, I think there's a bit of a view whether we've covered clearly enough the nuances in the expenses. So there's various words being used in the standard, like acquisition expenses relate back to the cost of acquiring the insurance business. Other places it talks about expenses incurred in fulfilling insurance contracts. And then somewhere else it goes away and throws a nice little curveball to the left-hand side, having read those and thinking we're not too far away from where we were in the old world. you've got this left-hand curve rule that says you must exclude any expenses that are not directly attributable at the portfolio level. And in my past experience with different accounting standards, directly attributable tends to be a fairly strong test. So I think there's a real ongoing conversation needed with our accounting colleagues to really get to what this really does mean in practice. And I suspect that may ultimately go to TRG for a discussion as well. We've kind of covered it. How well we've covered it, I know from some of the feedback there's different views. But anybody else has got a view on expenses or that topic? No? The other good news is you now got a choice for what level you do things at, so long as you can get answers at the right level. The standard fairly supports that you don't have to go away and do things at an individual contract level. You can do them in portfolio, you can do them in group, so long as you can get answers either by allocating down sensibly or aggregating up to the level at which you need to do the measurement. So a lot of them, if you're doing core requirements, is probably group, whereas PA is much more portfolio unless you get it so onerous. And you can just do it at that level, apart from possibly when you're doing assessment of onerous and deception, you may have to go down to individual. And then taxes, yes? You've got to wait for a...
Thanks. I have a number of questions, but I'm only going to ask one of the questions.
Yeah.
And that is the exercise of guaranteed insurability options.
Yeah.
So if it's within the contract boundary, you have to include all the cash flows relating to that exercise of that
yep.
option.
On an expected basis.
On an expected basis, of course. Is that all the cash flows, or is that the extra cost of the guarantee, you know, the fact that you're going to probably have...
You've got to get the expected value materially right. That's a okay. short answer for an accounting term. Now, if you think about the expectation of how often they get exercised, what those net outcomes, those cash flows are, I think in a lot of cases you could probably argue that, but you'd actually have to have a conversation with the auditors and be convinced
because
it's not.
The implications of the question is if you include all the cash flows,
yeah.
You know, on a gross basis, not just the extra cost,
yeah.
if you like, then in once the contract rolls over into a new group, then you have to exclude those cash flows if you've counted all of them.
What do you mean if it rolls over to a new group? That's
well, as you renew it, a new group is set up.
Well, say
that is the case, you renew it, and then if you've already counted all the cash flows related
well, no,
to
no,
that
no.
option.
If it's in the... You only measure what's inside the contract boundary, so if you're saying if you renew it, it's a new group, you've just said anything at that point is now outside your first measurement. So you'd only measure your expected exercise of continuation options up to the contract boundary and what they would do within that boundary.
Okay, because my interpretation was if you exercise the option, you have to include all the cash flows, even if it's outside of the current
contract. No, only
within
the contract boundary. The contract boundary is your starting point. That frames what's inside your measurement. Once you've got sorted out what that is, which I know in some cases is a bit of a debate, but that
yeah.
ultimately bounds it.
Okay.
It helps. And then taxes is a bit of a challenge as to whether or not you can include your investment tax on your investment income on, say, conventional IL book, et cetera. I think you make an argument, this tie back to fiduciary duties, given the tax, and it says it's payable because it's tax payable on behalf of the policyholder. So I think given that the Tax Act for VPST-type business and SEA business ties it back to policyholder tax rates and really makes clear this is a policyholder and the shareholder tax is separate, you can get there. I think it's going to be a real challenge to get there with ordinary business where the Tax Act doesn't really care because the tax rate's the same. So it makes no distinction. The fact that you actually reduce the benefits for that for the taxes doesn't actually enable you to make the argument you're paying the tax on behalf of the policyholders. Really, the argument can be just as easy. You're paying, reducing the benefits to allow for the fact you're paying tax. As you're able to get your return. So that's one area that's worth watching. And then this is the fun chapter on contractual service margin, if there wasn't any other questions on the previous one. The good news is this kind of looks nice and simple, so long as you know how to work out a risk margin, you worked out what expenses go in. Apart from those nuances, it's basically what people are doing, MOS, are familiar with. You basically make sure you've got no profit at inception. Having set all those pieces aside, it's your balancing item at inception. You now set it up, and thereafter it doesn't behave anything like MOS. But at least it starts off familiar, which is good news. So there's challenges in updating. I don't know if anybody's read through, wants to bring up particular points, or we can just talk to a few of them if it helps. No? I know there is VIF. You basically have to adjust the CSM for differences between the experience on your premiums received, and there's a bit of debate about whether that's for premiums received relating to future service at the end of the period you're doing the measurement at, or the start of the period. If it's the start of the period, it looks really odd, but there is an argument out there that that is a valid interpretation. Investment component is really about dealing with another issue. It takes it out, so you don't actually get investment component impacts hitting your... So what it's doing there is taking it out of your fulfillment cash flow adjustment later, because you haven't actually got somebody surrendering when you expected, and your investment component hasn't got out. And then you basically got a now, and unlike Moz, it's not a assumption change. It actually is a change in the estimates of future expected cash flows that you had for the end of the period, vis-a-vis what you now have when you get to the end of the period. And it's all based on the original discount rate, just to make it even more fun. And the risk adjustment, technically if you read the standard, requires you to do the, it also includes the risk adjustment inside that, and you've got to strip out time value effects on the risk adjustment in theory. But my understanding of why they, but they don't require you to do that for disclosure. My understanding, the original reason they didn't do that was originally they thought that was getting too complicated, and I suspect this is a oversight. They took it out of disclosure, but didn't notice they hadn't taken it out of here. So sooner or later we'll ask them the question whether that was the case. And then having got all of that done, you finally got to this large number at the end of the period, you then have to actually go and release it in proportion to coverage units, which is another very light topic. And you can tell it's light because the paper on that is about three times the length of the one on the contract boundaries that the TRG's put up. And that basically means, effectively, you've now got a very different beast. So this is nothing like Moz, because everything that's just changed, your assumptions, your experience, premiums received, assumptions about the future, they've all changed what you've got for CSM at the end of the period, and therefore what you're going to release. And then your coverage units that you do the release on, you also update those assumptions about the future coverage to work out your release pattern as well. So that also changes. So everything changes you release. So it becomes much more like those, like an EV process, not a, where effectively how you explain this outcome depends on which one you want to do your analysis. It's as good as it is depending on what you want to have up front or not up front. So this basically, these few graphs start to, these are ones pinched out of the, and then apologies, but I focused, given this is core requirements, I really focused on the life side, because the core requirements issues aren't really there on the GI apart from the NMI and a few other sides. We've got different issues on coverage. And so effectively, and this nice graph really shows you three things. One, unsurprisingly, the view is, if you read a state reading on the standard and basis of conclusion, they probably meant, I'm pretty sure the staff and the board, when they put right the standard, meant insurance as a service, nothing else. And effectively, if you do that for a conventional policy, as you expect, you get a sum at risk that runs off very fast, which is the purple line. You've got a surrender value, which is going up, not quite as fast, and that's because we are actually allowing for expected lapses of the usual 3% or whatever it is for a conventional book. It's pretty low. And if you put them together, which is the case we're arguing is the alternative view of coverage, to really include the investment component, then you get the nice yellow line, which gives you a much more sensible release pattern. And what this does is if you go with the release on sum at risk, you get that grey dotted line as the way your profit margin releases, which basically means if you've got conventional par books, most of your profit is going to be recognised at the day you do transition. If we get it to the other one, which we actually can, so we're basically arguing in this paper that you can actually allow for the quantity of benefit is actually the account balance, the surrender value plus the sum insured, which is a death benefit under the conventional at that time. Then we get the red one, which gives you a much more sensible looking pattern. This is another example. This one's an IL example, which we put up, which is much starker. We're trying to convince the board that notwithstanding their basis for conclusion, the basis for conclusions was flawed, and hence they should quietly jump over one obvious interpretation to a sensible one. So this one basically says if you've got an IL vested link policy with an insurance rider, which is basically insuring 5 times salary and up to after allowing for the death balance, which is why the sum insured runs off, and we're assuming that there's a profit margin in this example, about 10% pricing margin on your insurance and 15 on your insurance and 10 on your investment link. Your profit, as you can see, all the red part is the profit that comes out from your insurance. The green is the profit that comes out of your investment part, which is much more later. And the wonderful blue line is the CSM release you get if you actually have to do the release based on just the sum insured at risk. And the really nasty thing on this is, if you ever had sum insured on this contract, even if it no longer has the sum insured, so there's no sum at risk today, if it's ever had one, it remains an insurance contract for the rest of its life. So at transition, you're going to have to go back and find them all. Because you're going to pull them out and put them back into the insurance stand.
Grant, I might have to speed you up a little bit.
Yeah, please. Sorry. I think we're just about, and this one just is highlighting the core requirements on coverage units. This is random IP, so we're running an argument about, with IP, if you've got basically a $100 per month benefit, and the coverage you're providing somebody at age 20 who has got an age 65 benefit, it's about $540,000 if you don't assume he recovers. It's a lot lower if he does assume he recovers. And what that does, the second graph just kind of shows that makes a big difference to the profit release. Luckily, if you're there for lapses, it's not so big. And then onerous is fairly easy. I don't think there's too much new here. It's just like MOZ, once your CSM hits zero, it's no longer a CSM. Then effectively you're onerous, you recognise it. You then have a loss component which you need to track. You then need to release the loss component over the time of the contract, so that by the time you get to the end of the contract's life, that loss component is zero. So if you've written the amount off now and you wait to halfway through the contract, you can only restore back a portion of it. And by the time you get to the end of the contract, you can't restore anything back. You can't do loss reversals when the contract's finished, which makes sense. I'm not sure how well that's been done under MOZ. Hope I doubt. Yeah. So is there any particular questions or concerns around those that people have got, that want to raise?
Coverage units is a really good example of something where two very sensible people can read one thing and think completely opposite once they've read it. So to Grant's point about reading that basis for conclusions and thinking, you know, the risk components included, equally you can find a lot of people who see that the investment and risk part is included. So one of the ASB TRG papers is around submissions is around coverage units, which is on the ASB's website. And hopefully, if that gets aired at the next international TRG, which we expect it will, we'll actually see some clarity about which way that. What did the ISB intend when they wrote this? And at least then you know whether you start with something you agree with or disagree with. So that's quite a good example. It's also a good example of something where this is a principles-based standard, and we don't want rules. We don't want a long list of how we must do things. And that became particularly clear when we're doing some examples for the GI side, because the myriad if similar but different products that came out of that was quite extraordinary. And if you set a rule for one, then you could get some unintended consequence on another. So it's a really good example of a paper where you can look and see the sort of issues and interpretation issues that we're facing.
I think it's going to be, if it gets to the main TRG, I suspect there's going to be a very long paper to read. The staff summarise all of it. It'll be interesting to see where they go on that one.
Okay, last opportunity for a question for Grant before we move on. Yeah, over here. Martin.
Yep. Am I right in saying that one of the differences to MOZ is that when you do have a change in future assumptions, you can get an immediate profit impact because your CSM is using inception discount rates, so when you change your PV for the future, you're using then current discount rates.
Yeah, you've got that disconnect when you remeasurement measure your fulfillment values, that's all done at current discount rates, whereas the CSM adjustment's all done at inception. And that just, those differences, whatever they might be, just drop straight into your P&L. Okay. Unless you actually decide to use OCI, which I think Brianna may mention briefly later.
Okay. Thanks very much, Grant. We might move on. So our next two speakers are Brett Pickett and Andrew Scott. So Brett has experience in Guernsey, the UK and Australia, and as an actuary in both the UK and Australia. He's consulted on IAIS and risk-based solvency to the Guernsey Financial Services Commission. And interestingly, previous to being an actuary, he was an economist at the Productivity Commission. I didn't know that. So. Andrew Scott's an independent consultant. He's got over 20 years' experience in non-life insurance, doing work for the big four accounting firms, insurers and reinsurers. So, Brett, over to you.
Thanks, Ian. I'm going to time myself. I'd like to be on time. Cool. All right, so I'm Brett. I want to first of all thank all the volunteers on my substream. They helped me research and write this chapter, so very much appreciative of those people. Also, I want to acknowledge the IAA. I actually obtained a draft paper from them, and that was actually quite vital in the early parts. They've actually just reissued another draft one, so we'll make sure that we go back and review what we've got in our paper and make sure there's an alignment or see whether there's challenge. All right, so risk adjustment. It's the amount of compensation an entity requires for bearing uncertainty and variability in the cash flows arising from non-financial risk. So a lot of the early parts of this chapter is all about sort of what are we talking about in terms of non-financial risk. So before I start, these are sort of items I'd like you to give feedback to. If I was to learn from the previous speakers, I'm likely to get you feedback from you in writing on these. So again, readability, it's a technical subject. Have we given enough plain language? As well as technical, it's very technical. Have we been too technical or not technical enough? I'm very happy to get into technical details and throw it in. There is a lot of interaction with other chapters. It's the degree to which the risk adjustment can actually act as a volatility buffer. And that's interesting. That's covered in Brendan's chapter in chapter seven. There's also relating to the reinsurance, the extent to which sort of it, you're calculating a reinsurance risk adjustment, then calculating the net, making sure they're all appropriate. That's covered in the reinsurance chapter. And then there's the calculating risk adjustment and transition. That's captured in chapter 12, which is later on by Brown. All right. So most of the chapter itself is sort of set out relating to, okay, first of all, what are we talking about? All right. What are we talking about in terms of the risks and uncertainty? So we've sort of specified, I think the first step is to work out what risks are underlying the actual underlying contract, and then identifying which ones those are financial and non-financial. So we're particularly interested to see whether you think there's any of the risks are ambiguous. I know there is one, and that is the cash flows for reinsurance, you need to allow for the probability of default. All right? So you allow for that in the cash flows. But in any adjustment you make, there's going to be some uncertainty. That uncertainty is in the risk adjustment. So I think there's a little bit of confusion, but there is some. So that is in the risk adjustment, although it's not going to be that material. I just want to point it out there. So I'm very, very interested to see whether you can find me a list of any of the ambiguous risks and whether we've captured them correctly or not. It'd be really useful. The next one relates to the risk aversion. I'd like to show of hands who is actually who's thinking of setting their confidence level between 70 and 80%. Lo and behold, somewhere near 75. Who's thinking of somewhere higher, above 80%? Someone right? Obviously below 70%, or I guess that most people haven't actually thought that yet or don't want to divulge it. All right. Okay.
Brett, maybe a question is along the lines of your last point. How many people in the room have actually seriously considered the confidence level that they intend to use? Is it too early, or so hands up if you've actually spent any serious time on this issue? Okay, so for those on the webinar, there's about three or four rooms gone up in the hand.
Okay.
Sorry, three or four hands gone up in the room.
All right. So we don't actually talk about commercial implications of setting that confidence interval, but a company that's actually writing a new product, that's going to defer profits, or else equals. But a company that's actually in a steady state, the risk adjustment is the stuff that gets released on your back book, it's going to pay for the stuff that you bring on for the new business, and therefore you're pretty much going to be in a stable state. So the company is actually running down, the profit margins will actually kick out profit, whereas previously if you were using a premium car, you'd have nothing. So it actually can be useful. Diversification benefits, the company can determine the degree to which they allow for that. You've got a choice. You can set it either at really high aggregate level or at actually much more portfolio or grouping level. If you choose to calculate it at the more granular portfolio level, just be careful, because when you aggregate up, you might actually get to a confidence interval that's above your risk appetite or risk aversion. And then what you need to do is take an adjustment and bring it back down to the lower level. Quantification, we do take a bit of, go in there and talk about cost of capital approach, confidence interval approach. There's a tail VAR approach. I don't think anyone's from Canada or Bermuda here. Probably won't. I would expect those to be using that. Can I get a show of hands who's thinking probably just using confidence interval approach? Yeah. Can I get a show of hands who doesn't know yet? Yep, thank you. I thought so. All right. So, All right. So, okay. So most people didn't know. Is anyone actually thinking of the cost of capital approach? I know it'd be quite 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Is that because you guys got parents back in Solvency II, or? Okay. So you still know you'd have to calculate back end, calculate the confidence interval associated with it. Yeah. Okay. That's good. No problem. And communication. There's also the importance of actually being able to tell the board how you've calculated the confidence interval, how you've calculated the risk adjustment, and being able to communicate that. So in terms of risk mitigation, we pulled out all stuff relating to reinsurance. It's in its own chapter. But there's also a fair amount in there relating to profit shares. Interesting enough, depending on the profit share arrangement, you can get to a risk adjustment that's nil, depending whether you've got a loss share or past experience profits. Is anyone would like us to include more or less examples? I'm particularly interested in that. I know I threw in a cost of capital one. It's very simple. Probably isn't going to be much use unless you actually want. It'll be interesting initially, but then we need to know more than that. So I'm interested in that feedback as well. So that's 6.5 minutes. Right. So the second. So my substream also split in half, and the other half provided research and wrote the chapter on discount rates. So again, I want to thank them. Again, we also took the information from the IA, and they're actually writing their own monograph on discount rates, which has already been published, so that would be very useful. They've actually published one on the risk adjustments, which I think it's still in draft. They haven't published it yet. So when that comes out, that'll be very technical. I've read it. It's very technical. All right. So Andrew and I are going to take turns in this one. I'm just going to provide the initial theory stuff, and then he's going to provide some practical implementation. So you'll get a break from me in a moment. So again, the sort of feedback we're looking for is readability. Do we cover everything you need to know? Is there material omissions or errors? And also, is technical content too little, too much? From my point of view, Discounting is what we do and breathe, so it doesn't really feel that different than what we currently do. A lot of the core principles are pretty similar. Can I get a show of hands who shares that same view? Okay. Yep. Who thinks it is quite different and we'll have to think more deeply about it? All right, we got one. Good to have. Who doesn't know yet and still need to go through the standard? All right, two. All right, thank you very much. We pulled a direct comparison between IFRS 17 and the current accounting standards because we thought it would be just, we prefer people just to think the current, the new standards and not do a direct comparison. But it's an actually interesting research paper if any student or young actuary would want to do so. Come talk to me first because I'll have already got some stuff for you. All right, so in the paper, the first section we talk about sort of the discounting rates for under the core model, under the variations. If you take the OCI option, if you don't take the OCI option, we provide a table. Also, we've also provided a diagram to help you sort of work through decisions. So particularly interested if anyone's used that or if you do use that, whether you find that useful or not. Again, we're trying to sort of cater for two different people, one who's just looking for a tabletop information or one who's just looking for that decision tree. Then the rest of the bulk of the actual chapter relates to discounting when the cash flows do not relate to the underlying items. We've got a caveat, most of that is sort of generic actuarial content, so we have a bit minded whether we put it in or not put it in. So we've got two approaches that could be done, bottom up or top down. Again, can I get a show of hands who's thinking of doing a top down approach? All right. Do I have one? No? Okay. No one's looking to do that. Can I get a show of hands who's thinking of doing a bottom-up approach where you calculate risk-free rate and add a liquidity premium? Okay, most of the people. And who doesn't know yet? Okay, thank you. So very few people don't know, but most people are probably going to do a bottom-up approach, in which case the chapter actually has some content relating to the risk-free rates, swap curves, government bond curves, a little bit on corporate bonds. There's relates to the extrapolation, how you get from the most liquid point to the ultimate rate, looking at your sort of the user constant spot rate, constant forward rate, an ultimate spot rate, and ultimate forward rate, and the pros and cons of each, and what happens if you choose one and the impact on the forward rate. We also have some details in there about the liquidity premium, methods to calculating it, being mindful of the information on APRA's website, and also the Institute's 2011 working party. So there's a question in there whether we should actually update that to liquidity paper, that paper. So interested in your views on that. All right, in the back end, we talk about discounting where the cash flows are dependent on the underlying items, and we have two views on those ones. One's relating to where there's no underlying guarantees, and the other one where there is. In the interest of time, I won't go through those too much. But Andrew's going to now talk about some interesting implications, and I'll move away from the theory.
Good morning, everyone. Discount rates. I've been looking at these for about 20 years and going through the examples of the IFRS 17 examples, they are fairly simple, so you do need to read between the lines to some extent. And it's not until you actually start thinking about putting them into practice that you realise there's probably more to it. In looking at fitting these, there are two commonly accepted models, the Nelson-Siegel model and also the Svensson model. It depends at what stage you're at in the yield curve, whether it's an inverse one or a normal curve as to the best fits you can usually achieve. It also depends on where the RBA is in terms of its cash rates and what's happening at the inception of those curves. You're probably all familiar with these in that the data points here can be referred to either the Commonwealth Government securities, which are, of course, AAA. You can also fit it to swap curve, which are more liquid and may have more data points. Unfortunately, swap curves usually reference bank rates, which are AA, so you need to adjust for the credit risk in those. You can also refer to semi-government bonds. Again, their rate is slightly less than AAA. And, of course, there's corporates, which have a myriad of credit ratings attached to them. It could be that you need to use a blend of all of those in order to push the curve out to the sort of durations you need. Although you can see on this one, this is a fairly recent one, it goes out to almost 30 years, which is pretty good, actually, historically in Australia. Should cover most instances. I've also looked at New Zealand ones where they're not quite so long, so you do have to adopt some methods to try and extrapolate those, and that's why we suggest using these sort of mathematical fits, which are good for doing that. They also give you all the interim points in between the tradable securities where you'll need to project your cash flows to. So looking at how these work through the financial accounts in AASB 17, again, the examples given you refer to fixed constant rates, so there might be 4%, 5%. So when you wrap all that up in an NPV and then unwind it through the accounts, it just unwinds at the same rate. So it's fairly simple, again, being 4 or 5%. Unfortunately, the reality is a little more complicated. As we saw on the previous slide, our yield curves do vary over time, depending on the maturity date. So the discounting does apply to both the contract outflows and the CSM separately. So both of those need to be tracked, and the examples work through those. One thing that comes up as a result of that is that the shape of those outflows may be different, in that the contract outflows may be skewed, but the CSM ones may not be, because they're determined by coverage. So if you have different shapes to your cash flows and you're applying a yield curve, which varies over time, then the overall rate applicable to each of those two items can differ. So in IFRS 17, the unwinding of the discount occurs through the P&L. And there are a couple of examples there. Example 2 shows you a linear one, and you can work through those in the papers. Examples 2A and 3A are non-linear. And that is expensed through the P&L. Then there are movements in the yield curve. So we all know yield curves are not stable over time. In fact, they move every day. And the examples there, it goes through the P&L's changing financial assumptions, so it's accounted for as a separate item. And there is example 6 that you can refer to. It actually varies the crediting rate on participating policies, which is a little bit different, but you can kind of read between the lines to see what should apply to movements in discount rates likewise. Sorry, over done. So these now apply to groups of contracts. So the yield curves are set initially at the inception date of these contracts. So the income will unwind through the P&L at the original dates, at the original yield curves, at the date at which the policies are written. Of course, when we're grouping them in 12-month blocks, the yield curves are not constant over that time. So the method is to use one of a weighted average across the 12 months. So you can either do, it's just a question of how often you want to do yield curves. I mean, you could do them monthly, or if you're super keen, you could even do daily ones. Last time I checked, policies were written over the course of the whole year. So presumably that's most business days. If you're then grouping them into a 12-month block, you need to calculate a weighted average across the year. Having done that, you can express it as a single point estimate. But they will differ depending on the class of business. So you've got liability lines that will be out to 3 or 5 years. You've got property lines, which will be of 12 months, of the order of 12 months. They will also differ according to the grouping and the timing of that group, whether it's last year's or this year's. And as alluded to earlier, they will differ for contract outflows versus CSM. So you can see here in the chart, we've fitted a curve to the points that we had in the previous slide. And you can imagine a weighted average across that curve applicable to a particular group of contracts. What you could do is record 2 initial estimates for each contract or group of contracts, one coinciding with the expected contract outflows and one coinciding with the CSM. And then having recorded that, you could do it as a group or for individual policies. You then keep that and that becomes your roll forward rate as you recognise the expense through the P&L going forward over the life of the contract.
Andrew, I'm just going to speed you up a bit, please.
So, groups, it's the last one. One way to simplify it is possibly choose your groups so they coincide with your valuation date. So the same, that would give you a 12-month block that basically runs through your financial year and ends at your financial year end. Alternatively, you can truncate a group. So if you're only 9 months into it and you reach balance date, just call the end of the group at that point. I believe the discussion paper talks about then adjusting that as you continue into the next year, but I see that as being probably too onerous. And this one, finally, we've just shown that the weighted average of the yields that you might want to use as your roll forward rate, one for the contract outflows and one for the CSM. Thank you.
Okay, any quick questions for Brett?
Yeah, I just want to add, as you go through time and you basically, this is the yield curve at inception, you're going to roll up it, right? So if you calculate a weighted average single discount rate, the following year that's going to change, right? Because you're going to be basically on a different weighting on a different curve. And as you go through time, that'll continuously change. So just be careful, it's not a single rate forever.
Questions? Yes, one over here, Mark.
So I've got a question for Brad. The distinction between the cost of capital method and the confidence interval disclosure is interesting. So am I right in saying that if you're saying that the amount of compensation you need to for bearing uncertainty of the life of a policy happens to equal the 75th confidence interval for the liability, that would be documented in a company's risk appetite statement, risk management framework. It seems unclear to me whether the confidence interval is an input or an output.
Okay, so the risk adjustment would captures the company's risk aversion. That risk aversion should be consistent with the company's risk appetite and would be within its risk management framework.
So that would be a disclosure which says for purposes of the accounts,
well,
75% of the confidence, because clearly confidence is 99.9-something percent.
So the 99.5 is probably the regulatory capital requirement. So this one is at a much lower level unless your board actually wants it that high. So there will be a disclosure relating to the confidence level, and Brianna will talk about that. And in that sense, yes, you will have to disclose at 75%. Whether the when you're pricing a product, your each company is going to have its internal targets, so whether it's an IRR or whatever, and it would I'd expect the risk aversion to be consistent with that as well.
Okay, one last chance for a question, and then we're going to move on. All right, let's take a break. We're running quite a long way behind, but we'll see what we can do to catch up. If you can be back here at 25 past, we'll start then. Thank you. Right, the next big section that we're about to address is variations to core requirements. And the first section Brendan Council is going to talk to, that's the PAA. So, Brendan, over to you.
Thanks, Ian. So I'm going to try and make up a little bit of time here because I'm hoping that this is, well, this is the simplified approach, so hopefully it's a bit more straightforward than some of the others. So the premium allocation approach, we've got the usual questions there. So this is Chapter 7. Is it clear? Is there anything, I guess, that... is not covered. We're keen to get your feedback on that. Maybe what might be useful for me, actually, if I could just get a show of hands in the room, life general health. So who here works for a general insurer or is most interested in general insurance aspects? Okay, so that's maybe a third. What about health insurance? Got one... to a couple of health insurers, okay, and how about life insurers? It's probably the remaining two-thirds or three-quarters. So, okay, so mainly life insurers. All right, so that's good to know. So what I'll do, as I said, I'll try and make up a little bit of time, but what I wanted to do is just call out some of the key questions. So I'm not going to go through all of those in the chapter. So the first two there, materiality considerations and variability, they relate to the eligibility to use the premium allocation approach. So recall if we've got a contract boundary of less than 1 year, then you're automatically able to use the premium allocation approach. If the contract boundary is more than 1 year, then you still can use the premium allocation approach, but there are some requirements in the standard that you need to satisfy before you can do that. So in order to use the premium allocation approach, the wording in the standard is along the lines, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, that the entity reasonably expects the liability for remaining coverage to not differ materially under the premium allocation approach to that under the general approach, and that assessment is done at inception of the group of contracts. So that's the first question there on materiality. So we've put in a few considerations on materiality, at what level the materiality is considered when assessing PAA eligibility, and also just some of the considerations around financial statement materiality. And we've also got a section up the front of the document that has some other guidance that you can refer to on materiality when making that assessment. So that's the first one. And actually, might just another show of hands. So some of the contracts that we expect might be impacted by this, so contracts that have a contract boundary of more than 1 year that might want to use the premium allocation approach. There's a few in the general insurance space and probably a few in the life insurance space. So I might just, is there anyone thinking, so some of the ones that I wrote down were life insurance group risk. Anyone thinking about PAA for that? Yep. One, two, three, four, yep. Five, okay, so probably half a dozen there. Also, some of the probably the other big ones are the general insurance contracts where the contract boundary might be more than a year, so construction contracts, builder's warranty, any of those? Yeah, Yep. And LMI is the other one that's topical at the moment, with the TRG in particular on coverage units. Yeah. Okay, so no one at the moment. Okay. So that's eligibility. So have a look at question 7.5. That covers materiality. Question 7.6 is around variability of cash flows. So the standard has a paragraph in there that talks about when there is significant variability in the fulfillment cash flows in the period before the claim is incurred, then that would mean that you might not be able to use the premium allocation approach. And the examples called out in the standard itself are products where there are longer coverage periods and there's an asymmetry in the cash flows, like embedded derivatives, etc. So this question 7.6 is one that was very topical, and as an example, if you read the paper of diverging views within the industry on some of the considerations around what do we mean by variability of cash flows, and the specific question is around the risk adjustment and how that feeds into the fulfillment cash flows when doing this assessment. So a couple of views there that we couldn't get to a consensus on. I might not, just given time, I might not go through that in detail, but what I would like, if there is anyone that has read that particular question and has a view either way, it would be helpful to get thoughts on that, or feedback or comments, and also support for the arguments either way. And as I said, it's a little bit technical to go through right now. If anyone has read that particular section of the standard and has a view that they are prepared to put out today, happy to hear it now. Otherwise, it would be good to get feedback in the fullness of time on that one. Okay. Third topic, allocation of revenue. So this one is just around how revenue is allocated under the premium allocation approach. So under the general model, we've got coverage units, and there's a lot of discussion on those around the allocation of revenue. For the premium allocation approach, the standard talks about using the passage of time or the pattern of risk if that differs materially from the passage of time. So again, we've got some information there on question 7.7, I think it is, on some considerations around where the allocation of revenue might differ from the passage of time. And I think there are a few products, particularly general insurance type products, where there might be some seasonality over the coverage period that we've called out there. But if there are any others or any other considerations that we might have missed, would be particularly interested in that feedback. Questions 7.8 and 7.9 cover onerous contracts. So that is when we, under the general model, that would be when you have extinguished your contractual service margin. It's the requirements are simplified under the premium allocation approach, so you still do need to assess any onerous contracts, but you can effectively assume that you don't have any onerous contracts in your portfolio unless facts and circumstances indicate otherwise. We've tried to put a little bit of wording in there around what that means, so how far you might have to dig, and probably would emphasise that you don't need to go digging deeply for, or we believe you don't need to go digging deeply for onerous contracts or onerous groups of contracts. There's wording in there about using all reasonable supportable information available without undue cost or effort, and that's another phrase that comes up quite a bit in the standard around undue cost or effort. So hopefully that just gives you, again, it's a very subjective area when you need to identify onerous contracts when you can assume that you don't have any. But hopefully that guidance will be somewhat helpful. And then question 7.9 just covers, I guess, a bit more on the calculation methodology. So once you've identified onerous contracts, how you would measure those under the premium allocation approach, which is again a little bit more simple than the loss component approach that you have under the general model. I'll cover the final topic that is probably very topical at the moment in the Transition Resource Group, premiums received. So again, go on to the AASB Transition Resource Group website to have a look at the paper that's been done, or papers that have been done on that topic. The standard requires that the liability for remaining coverage is based on premiums received, which is a different approach than we're used to, where we might have an unearned premium reserve approach, where there's coverage being provided whether the premium has been received or not. We will still reserve for that. So that one is very topical at the moment. We're trying to that's going to the ISB TRG, and hoping to get some movement on that, because I think there's a couple of implications. One is it does result in a lot of operational complexity, because you need to track whether you've received the premium from the policyholders or the groups of policyholders, and feed that into actuarial models. So that's generally coming from a cash receipts or a different system. And tracking that at group of contract level may be difficult for some. And the second is you can get these funny outcomes where you're actually on risk, but you're not holding a liability because you haven't received the premium, or you might have a negative liability. So a few issues around that, which will go to the TRG. In the task force paper, we've just tried to set out that issue so people understand it, by way of a simple worked example. So happy to take any comments or feedback on that. So those were the key things I wanted to cover. Hopefully we've made up a little bit of time there, Ian. Yes, I'm happy to take questions.
Yeah, thanks very much, Brendan. Are there any quick questions for Brendan before we move on? It's probably the easiest part of the whole thing to understand, I think. But, I might be kidding myself on that as well. Yeah, there's one question. Yep, in the middle there.
The standard says when we can reasonably expect the result of a PEA approach to be similar to a core approach, we can adopt a PEA approach. And do we need to conduct the exact calculations to make a reasonable expectation? Or can we just form the expectation by virtue of an argument?
Well, I think if you can support an argument, then there's nothing that says you need to do a full model, but I guess it would depend on the product and the coverage period and all the parameters that are going into that. So I think, I guess as long as you can support your argument, there's nothing that says you need to build a building block model, but it's something that you might want to consider, again, depending on the circumstances, variability of cash flows, length of coverage period, how significant you think the difference could be over time.
Okay, look, let's move on because we are short of time. Our next speaker, thanks very much, Brendan. Our next speaker is David Rush. David's got many years' experience with the development and implementation of insurance accounting standards. He's a member of the TRG, the AASB TRG, Professional Standards Committee of the Institute, and the Task Force. He's worked in various places, including AMP, APRA, KPMG, And I think it's fair to say that he is the walking, breathing expert on VFA. That's what you're going to talk about. So, David, over to you.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know anybody's a walking, talking, breathing expert on VFA. As we've done with a couple of the other, all of the other chapters, what I want to ask is basically, does the VFA chapter, which is chapter 8 in the information note, does it actually work for you? Is it clear what needs to be done, especially what needs to be done differently? So, first of all, can I have a show of hands? Who thinks it's pretty clear what they need to do? No. Okay, don't know how to take that. So the rest of you think it's not necessarily clear?
David, one of the things we should check is how many people is the VFA actually relevant for? That would be interesting. So how many? Put your hands up if the VFA... Okay, so 7 or 8 people, right? So start with them.
All right. The rest of you don't go to sleep yet. Okay. For those of whom it is relevant, it may not necessarily be clear what needs to be done. Secondly, is there any other issues that we haven't covered in the VFA chapter that you need to know about? Now, I won't ask about that yet because I want to go through what I think are the issues, but then if you think that there are other issues, please raise them at the end. I will also note that what we've tried to do in the VFA chapter is to make sense of what the standard actually says. There are certain things in the standard where you kind of scratch your head and say, what the hell are they going on about here? So one example is paragraph B113 in the standard. It's not really clear at all what they're trying to say. We've tried to give an interpretation or our understanding in response to question 8.30 to that, but I will note that there are certain things that aren't clear in the standard. Okay. So there are a number of issues that still need to be resolved or that I think companies will face as they implement the VFA for their investment-type business. The first is what business it actually applies to. So one thing that particularly needs to be noted is that this VFA chapter on the VFA method will apply broader than just the par business that companies are kind of used to at the moment. It will also include any unbundled investment linked business that a company might have as well. If it can be unbundled, then you basically just do as you currently do, and the IL bit is treated under another accounting standard. But if it can't be unbundled, and the key test there is the lapse test, both the investment component and the insurance component need to be able to be lapsed independently and continue independently of each other if they do lapse. If that can't happen, then they need to be bundled together, and then the whole thing needs to be treated as insurance. So some of what we currently account for as investment linked will instead be accounted for as insurance under the VFA method. The other thing is the treatment of group risk business that has profit share facilities. And on that, the jury is still out as to whether the VFA actually applies to that or doesn't apply to it. There are arguments that it does apply because it meets the various criteria that are applicable to use of the VFA. But however, one of the things is not actually in the actual criteria, but more broadly speaking, the VFA applies to investment-related business. And an argument can be put that group business is not really investment-related business, whether it has profit share or not. It's not really investment-related business. And on that basis, the group business isn't applicable for the VFA. So there can be arguments both ways. That's one of the issues that needs to be resolved. The second issue that needs to be resolved, or that you need to be aware of, is this distinction between the way bonus is calculated and the available assets and the underlying items that are used to calculate that bonus. Under the current approach, those two are kind of linked. Your determination of what is the bonus and what is your accounting liability, those two are kind of linked. Under AASB 17, those two things are totally separate. You need to first of all work out what the bonus is, or the supportable bonus is, under the contract. And for that, you might use the available assets for the underlying items. You refer to the Life Act, and that guides what you might determine are the bonuses under the contract. They are then included as part of the cash flows that you use in the calculation of liability using the VFA approach under AASB 17. So bonuses and liability calculation under AASB 17 are separate. The third thing is the treatment of non-investment experience. Currently under LPS 340, I think it is, basically non-investment experience is taken out of the value of supporting assets. It's done all the time. LPS 340 says that's what you have to do. Under AASB 17, the treatment of non-investment experience, that non-investment experience, is a little bit more nuanced. And it depends on what goes through the pool, what doesn't go through the pool, those sort of things. That's basically the paragraph B113 that I was referring to earlier on. I've said that the cash flows need to allow for expected bonuses. There is also some uncertainty, which was mentioned earlier, around expenses, around what are attributable and what aren't. So that needs to be, there are differences there. But also, one thing that's different is that currently you actually split the expenses between what is attributable to the policyholder and what is attributable to the shareholder. Under AASB 17, everything is attributable to the shareholder. And what you do, the policyholder's share of bonuses, share of expenses, is basically taken account of in determining what the bonuses are. So the policyholder share of expenses, that will reduce the bonuses, which are then included in the cash flows, and so on. So in terms of the actual liability calculation under the VFA approach, all expenses are deemed to be attributable to the shareholder. As I think was mentioned also earlier on, there is still some debate around the definition of fiduciary as regards to tax. AASB 17 says that you can count as cash flows which need to be modelled and so forth. You can include in that all taxes which are fiduciary in nature, or words to that effect. And paid on behalf of the policyholder. So the policyholder tax, there are questions about whether the policyholder tax is actually fiduciary or not fiduciary. Some would say it is, some would say it isn't. For some businesses it might be, for some businesses it might not be. So the jury is still out on whether that is fully allowed for in the VFA. There is differences in the accretion of interest. Normally, as was explained earlier, you calculate the CSM at inception and then you roll it forward in future years, and you use the interest rate in that roll forward. You use the interest rate that applied at inception. But for the VFA business, you don't use the interest rate that applied at inception, you use the current interest rate. So there's a difference there. And lastly, the risk adjustment. It should be noted that the risk adjustment here is is in relation to the risk that's faced by the entity, i.e. the shareholder. Not the total risk, but just the risk that's faced by the shareholder. So therefore, if you predominantly have, for example, broadly 80-20 type business, 80% of the risk is borne by the policyholder. Only 20% of the risk is borne by the shareholder. That is what you need to set up a risk adjustment for. You don't need to set up a risk adjustment for the whole lot. Lastly, in terms of profit release, so we're used to releasing profit basically in proportion to bonuses on par business. Well, the release of profit under AASB 17, we've mentioned covered units, so the CSM part of profit will be released in proportion to coverage units, but then the amount of profit that relates to the risk adjustment, as that's released, that also is counts as profit. That's basically released in accordance with what you need, what you did need for the allowance for risk, what you currently need, the difference gets released as profit. Okay. And lastly, I will note that there may well be some issues in relation to friendly societies and in relation to mutualisation, particularly in relation to the last thing. Does mutualisation change in any way the aggregation or the grouping that you can do? We're not quite sure. It would seem, for example, that mutualisation certainly does allow you to basically move cash flows that would be attributable to this group can be measured in a different group given mutualisation. Now, does that change the level of aggregation that you might have, the level of grouping that you might have? That question still out. And certainly in regards to friendly societies, there are questions that need to be resolved there, which we haven't gone into at the moment. So those are the issues that I've identified. Are there any others that people have, or any questions that people might want to ask?
So let's keep it brief. I know there are only a few people really going to spend time on this topic. So are there any pressing comments or questions that people have? No, if not, thanks very much, David. So
shows how relevant the VFA is to
it. Well, the world's moved on, but isn't it? It's really quite interesting.
David, it'll depend whether your treatment of group risk and profit share is going to be under the VFA or not.
In terms of the risk adjustment?
In terms of our interest in this topic.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, okay. So if group risk is caught by it, then there'll be a lot more people interested. That's very true. So the next topic is actually, as indicated earlier, a very complex one, and that's reinsurance. Andrew's going to talk to us about it. I've given him a big challenge because he's got a lot of slides and he can't possibly get through them. So he's going to hit the high points and focus on the things that you find a challenge. So, Andrew, over to you.
Thanks, Ian. It's nice to know that we've been presented with what everyone considers the most challenging topic. I certainly don't advocate that we'll have all the answers today. Rather, this is more just to flag the issues to you and get you thinking about the topic. So we'll just quickly go through the terminology, because reinsurance can live in a world unto itself. Actually, do we have any reinsurers in the room? It's about 7 or 8. So please feel free to step in. We'll also look at, very quickly, classification and grouping issues specific to reinsurance, special features. We'll very quickly touch on the examples. Talk about risk margins and some allocation issues which are particularly relevant for reinsurers. So terminology, and there are various terms used throughout reinsurance, some of which differ in meaning and some of which have the same meaning depending on who you're talking to. The one I like is inwards reinsurance versus outwards. So inwards is simply that reinsurance accepted by a company, typically a reinsurer. And outwards is when you buy reinsurance as an insurance company. So you'll go out and transfer your risk and pay a premium. The standard refers to that as reinsurance held and reinsurance accepted. And sometimes it doesn't refer to either. So reinsurance is typically done through treaties or facultative. Facultative is pretty, I think we're all familiar with, it's just offer and acceptance, risk by risk. Treaties, however, are basically bound business for a period of 12 months. So a insurer will enter into a treaty with a reinsurer and cede all their new business to them for a defined period. And typically they renew annually, and the terms may change at renewal. So reinsurance accept inwards business as ordinary contracts of insurance from their point of view. So they basically operate as though they were insurance contracts in terms of IFRS 17. Insurers can typically cede business to reinsurers as outwards, but they can also write their own inwards reinsurance business with another insurance company. Very quickly, the grouping for reinsurance can differ, mostly for historical reasons. However, APRA does still make a distinction between proportional and non-proportional, and it also separates them into categories A, B, and C. And there you can see the equivalent classes of insurance business that correspond to each of those. So in effect, there's six categories: A, proportional, non-proportional, B, and so on, for the purposes of regulation. Now, it could well be, as a reinsurer, you want to adopt those, or you may have other requirements according to an overseas head office. Insurers would typically classify, you think they would typically classify their reinsurance assets in accordance with their insurance class groupings. But they may have reasons not to. So quickly, you can just go through. We have a definition for proportional. This is taken from APRA's website. Basically, you're sharing the same proportion as the insurer, between insurer and reinsurer. Non-proportional, I think we're all familiar with excess of loss cover, where the reinsurer will carry more of the risk than the insurer. And life business has its own classification of groupings, but it's not my area of expertise. So I've just listed the ones on as per APRA's website. It could well be the reinsurance, for purpose of reinsurance, you just adopt those classes. So reinsurance, special features. So certainly it must be accounted for as a separate asset on the balance sheet. So essentially an independent valuation of each reinsurance contract. I mean, presumably it would be derived from the underlying insurance contract. And in terms of groups of contracts, we also have the neat positioning of treaties being 12-month renewable. So it could well be that as a reinsurance treaty, there is your definition of a group of insurance contracts. There is one issue that does come up, is that reinsurance can be treated asymmetrically to the equivalent insurance. So in other words, the asset held by the insurer may be different to the liability accepted by the reinsurer. And I think this is an issue that's recognised as one that hasn't yet been resolved internationally. And we'll see on the next slide some possibilities for that. Asymmetry probably is not that new to the industry. I mean, we have asymmetry between different insurers accepting the same risks and giving you different prices, or accounting for them differently. So it's not a huge challenge. So if we just look at the concept of reinsurance treaties, and above the line is the insurer's point of view, and the balance date is midway through there. The below the line is from the reinsurer's point of view, and the inception date for a treaty can precede the balance date but can then also run over beyond it. So the question is, and this is probably one that's still unresolved, is whether from the reinsurer's point of view the treaty carries beyond the balance date and includes all unbound business. And if it does, then you're in the position of not having any information about the policies that you will be accepting in that period, because by definition it's still unwritten business. The insurer is pretty clear that it only includes policies up to the balance date, so only bound business. But they could take a perspective that as an asset they also have the treaty carrying on beyond the balance date. Possibilities that may affect your interpretation of that is whether you have you're able to cancel that treaty at some point, whether the insurer has that right, whether the reinsurer has that right, whether you have the right to reprice it along the way, whether it's paid up front in advance, or whether it's payable monthly in instalments. I believe that the life insurance equivalent would be a 3-year group life cover. So we'll just go through the... this is a very simple introduction to the reinsurance, treating it as an asset concept. These are covered in examples 11 and 12 of the standards. And here we treat reinsurance as an asset. So this is the ground-up approach for the underlying insurance contracts, where we have premium of $1,000 and expected liabilities of $900, giving rise to a future cash flow of $100 and a risk margin of $60. Now consider a 30% quota share on that arrangement. So you've got to consider two instances, one where there's inadequate premium, example A, and one where there's adequate premium, example B. And this basically is to demonstrate the point that the CSM can vary either way. So in example A, we have $270 of liabilities, but only $260 of income, so it's an onerous contract. However, the CSM does not drop down to zero because it still stays at 10 with a risk adjustment of 18, making up the difference. In example B, the reinsurance premium is $300, but the liabilities are $270, so this is a profitable contract. We still have a risk adjustment of 18. And the CSM becomes the difference between 18 and the present value of the future cash flows of 30, being 12. So the point being that it can flip either way when thinking about it as a reinsurance asset. Now this is example 12, which you can work through at your leisure. But this is basically the same quota share. We have $300 of estimated contract outflows and a risk adjustment of 100. So the equivalent reinsurance on this is 90, being 30% of the 300, and 25 based on the 100, but the example uses difference in pricing, so it's not a straight 30%. So the insurance contract liability is 115 in that example. Now, on reassessment of the reinsurance asset, given you have non-onerous underlying contracts, so the 300 we had previously is now 350, and the contract service margin has dropped down to 50, which takes us back to the 400 we had previously. And the equivalent reinsurance asset is 105, which is an increase on the previous one, and the contract service margin has dropped from where it was presently to 10, still giving us a balance of 110. However, if you have onerous contracts, On the left-hand side, we have 460 for the fulfillment cash flows, which is more than the premium. So there's no CSM. In fact, there's a loss of 60 in the first year. And so the equivalent reinsurance asset becomes a profit of 18 in the first year, which you can see. Sorry. So 460 is an onerous underlying contract. There's no CSM. And the equivalent reinsurance is now 138, which is an increase on where we were previously by the extra 160 and a 30% quota share, leaving us with a contract service margin of 5.
So we still speed you up a bit, Andrew.
Please. We still have one. So they're very simplistic examples and certainly don't answer all our queries today, but something that we can go away and consider further. The risk margins. The next topic for reinsurance is a consideration of the risk margins. And for here, you really need to consider that risk margins are considered for both reinsurance and insurance separately. So that means your gross risk margin or risk adjustment could be much higher than presently if you're considering just gross without reinsurance, and that the reinsurance could be substantially reducing that from where it is presently. For proportional contracts, it's pretty simple. It's the risk adjustment is ceded to the reinsurer in the same proportion as the quota share between the two parties. For non-proportional insurance or excessive loss, the risk adjustment or risk margin can actually exceed the proportion that you're ceding to the reinsurer. So, for example, on the right-hand side, you could be paying a reinsurance premium of 5%, but ceding 30% of your risk adjustment to them. Just as some more background, APRA has released papers on this previously. There's one put out by Robin Baton and Ian Reid, which is a little bit dated, but the theory is still pretty sound. And subsequent to that, APRA released its own survey, Risk Margin Adjustments, and that's shown. And the results of that survey are shown there. So you can see, typically, the proportional risk adjustment will be higher than the non-proportional equivalent, and it will also increase for your more uncertain classes. But you can go back and refer to those papers because they're quite useful. Just for reinsurance, there's the idea of umbrella covers. So these are the coverages that wrap around underlying covers, or you've got multiple cover. So catastrophic loss, portfolio quota shares, aggregate stop loss. A good example of that is the World Trade Center, where after its collapse, there were claims on business interruption, property, heaps of liability claims, so be it workers' comp, and dare I say a few life insurance claims as well. So these need to be allocated in many instances, so you can consider the contracts separately but then allocate them out. There's really no other way of doing it. IFRS 17 doesn't really specify any allocation methodologies, so I guess we're all free to choose between exposure, coverage, and loss, expected loss techniques to do that. And finally, portfolio transfers are quite relevant to reinsurers. Quite often they're commuting treaties. So the point here is that the multiple underlying covers then become one contract, and the assessment is at the point of conversion. It's no longer at the dates of inception. and it's usually repriced in the process too. So you have a new price, you have a new inception date, and you have multiple contracts that are seeded into one. And there's example 13 as per the IFRS 17, which is pretty simplistic in this instance. And I think that's it.
Thanks, Andrew. We've got, well, we are well behind time, but let's see if we've got any quick questions. Focus on things that are difficult to interpret or you're struggling to understand. Are there any particular points that anybody wants to raise?
This might be just a clarification. So I suppose the thing that is uncertain is the gross cost and reinsurance is just a mechanical overlay on top of that. So in terms of risk margins, is the proposal that, you know, you work out a percentile that you want to be, if you want a confidence interval approach, that you want your gross to be and then apply your reinsurance on top of that and then therefore drive the risk margin, or do you drive a risk margin for the reinsurance contract completely independently of the gross?
It's supposed to be completely independent. I guess historically, there's always been a level of reinsurance behind every insurance portfolio. So people have implicitly carried their risk adjustments on that basis, that they know they're not subject to extreme losses. But if you imagine your portfolio without, say, catastrophic cover, then maybe your risk adjustment should be substantially more, and that in buying that reinsurance, you're ceding a large part of that risk adjustment back to them.
Thank you. Just to clarify, that's a question of interpretation at the moment. So I think the other view is that you do your gross contract with a risk adjustment, considering the availability of reinsurance in the market, not the specific reinsurance that you may or may not have.
Another one over there.
Probably just a comment on one of your earlier slides. I may have misunderstood it, but when you were talking about proportional versus non-proportional reinsurance and the adoption of risk margin, that one, the first dot point, I'm not sure I agree with that first dot point. I'm not sure whether that's prescribed in the standard or someone's interpreting it, but if I think about proportional surplus life reinsurance, there'd be good reasons for thinking that the risk margin for the surplus treaty might be higher than the all-in risk margin on the assumed side. So I can certainly see reasons for difference between risk margin on a quota, risk margin on a surplus treaty differing, whereas risk margin on quota share, I think that point's much more valid for.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That example is designed around a simple quota share, and it does also assume parity of rates. So the example that you quoted would probably lie somewhere between the two.
Okay, good point, Duncan. Any other last minute questions? Going. Okay, thanks very much. So Briellen Cummings is now going to talk to us about presentation. Thanks, Andrew. Briellen is a partner with KPMG's actuarial and finance risk practice. She's got lots of experience, specialises in life insurance and wealth management, and spent the last two years working with companies implementing IFRS 17. So over to you, Briellen.
Thank you and good afternoon. So it's currently 12:15. I believe I was meant to end at 12:15, so I don't think I'll quite manage that, but I will try and catch us up on time considerably. Transition. So I'm covering transition and disclosure. So we have the typical questions here, does the chapter work for you, et cetera, which we may cover at the end. In terms of transition, look, when you think about transition, the standard says you first have to start with a full retrospective approach, which means you need to go back from when you first wrote that contract back in for life insurance companies, potentially 1980, 1970, along with all the other contracts that were in that cohort which have now lapsed. And you do IFRS 17 at that point and roll it all forward every year, including going through all your changes in assumptions, all your changes in models, et cetera, to get to where you are today. If that is not practicable, then you get to use the modified retrospective or the fair value. So the modified retrospective is where you get to apply a series of specified modifications. Each modification you're only allowed to use if you don't have reasonable supportable information or the fair value. So the key questions that the task force kind of considered when we looked at this, which, you know, sounds quite simple when we put it there, is firstly, what does impracticable mean? Because the full retrospective on the surface doesn't sound like a very fun thing to do, so most people would like to skip to something a bit easier if they can. So you have to look at sort of AASB 108 to find out what the definition of impracticable means, and it means when an entity cannot apply after making every reasonable effort to do so. So things are likely to be impracticable when you don't necessarily have all your data. And so even though you might have all your data on your current policies, consider whether you might have all the data on your lapsed policies. That's an easy way to sort of consider if you've had a change in PAS or something along the way. The second is if new assumptions are required, which would require hindsight to form. So a good example of this is your risk adjustment. Can you actually go back 5 years or so and say with confidence at that point in time what the confidence level of the company would be and what your risk adjustment might have been for a particular product, or are you informing that essentially applying information that you would have had after that balance sheet date? So those are the sort of the two areas where companies may not be able to do the full retrospective, even if they want to, because they would require hindsight to form assumptions or they don't have data. In terms of the modifications, if you wanted to then use the modified method, what sort of modifications could you use? Well, the first is that you can potentially group data together in terms of putting several years of data together rather than having individual cohorts. You can use a yield curve averaged over a number of years rather than having individual yield curves. You could apply a risk adjustment based upon the risk adjustment of current similar products rather than the risk adjustment at the time. You can use actual rather than estimated cash flows, and there's a number more. However, you may actually be forced to use the fair value even if you'd like to use the modified retrospective, because the only modifications you can make are the ones which are actually listed. And so if you issued a product a number of years ago, you don't issue that product anymore or a similar product anymore. You can't necessarily say what your risk adjustment would have been at the time. You don't currently issue a similar product, and therefore there's actually no modification that is available to you, and you're then potentially forced to use the fair value. In terms of the fair value itself, once again, you get to make a series of simplifications in that you can group, and you still need to group in terms of onerous or non-onerous contracts, etc., but you potentially get to do that grouping as at today rather than back at inception. You can also group together contracts that are more than 1 year. And finally, you actually have to say, well, how am I going to calculate this fair value? And in terms of the task force, this is sort of where we stopped. So we didn't tell anybody how we thought fair value should be calculated. We didn't really propose any methods at all. And this is something where I guess we're interested in as a task force to see, is there interest in us proposing methods of fair value? Bearing in mind that, you know, the conversation that was had at the start by Ian as to, you know, will this at any point in time have a standing greater than an information note? And so if it's an information note level saying how fair value might be calculated might be okay, but if it was elevated, that information may or may not come out. The final thing that I wanted to just sort of say is that when you go back and you do all these things, just remember that with reinsurance contracts, essentially every time that you change your reinsurance contract, you're typically negotiating that with the reinsurer, and therefore that will counter the contract modification under the modification rules, which were way back at about 9:30 this morning, if anyone can remember back that far. So you do need to then consider whether that's a significant modification and things like that as to whether whether that makes things simpler for the reinsurance or when that reinsurance treaty started. So the questions I had in this space, I guess for the task force's benefit, were how many people here have actually sort of considered transition at all? So there's about four or maybe about eight. How many people think that the full retrospective might be possible beyond a couple of years? So for most general insurers, we're using the PAA, they're probably using the full retrospective, but other than that, we're probably looking at having to do a number of methods. once you have to use a different approach other than full retrospective, has anyone given any thought to whether they prefer to use the fair value or they prefer to use the modified retrospective? Both for different products. And I guess feedback on what sort of guidance would anyone like in this space, because we did sort of end what we were giving at the point where the IFRS 17 ends, and we then didn't go on to sort of say, well, what can the actual profession actually add in this regard, or what can the Institute add in this regard in terms of guidance? Put your hand up if you're sort of happy with where we left it. Put your hand up if you'd like a bit more. Rightio, there's about 4 or 5 people are happy where we left it, about 2 people wanting a bit more, and the vast majority haven't thought about it yet, I gather. So just moving on to the next slide then. Oops. Financial statements and disclosure. So once again, the typical comments, which we're happy to get some feedback on afterwards. The financial disclosure itself, we have an accounting choice, which is impactful for the disclosures, which is, do we put changes in discount rate through OCI or P&L? So traditionally in Australia, we put our changes in discount rates through P&L, and now we get to make this choice. I think on the surface, a lot of companies initially thought that they might do P&L, and now a lot more are considering whether or not they might want to do OCI, but both those options are available. There's also a range of rather burdensome calculations needed to meet disclosure requirements, significant increase in the detail and complexity, detail reconciliations and so on, and there's definitely a need for finance and actuarial to work closely together for this to be a success. In terms of, I guess, when we wrote the information note, the bit on disclosures and financial statements, I think it might be about 3 pages or so. It's rather short, considering the vast amount of work that the disclosures will take. This is really the point, if there was never a point before this, where the actuarial kind of bit ends and the finance bit starts, in terms of having our finance colleagues give us tell us that we need to fill in lots of tables of information, etc. I would give a warning that if you're sort of building anything, to consider what you need for the disclosures at the start would be a good idea, because it's information you need for the disclosures which you don't actually need for any other purpose. Some of the information that you need are separation of policy groups into assets and liabilities, which is not the same as onerous and non-onerous contracts. That is not a matter of interpretation, but I think it's one which we're hoping that the IASB will relent on and actually change the standard in order for something which is extremely burdensome to every company in the world to get over. So there are a handful of things that we're actually hoping for a change in the standard, and that would be one of them. Secondly, the disclosing the confidence level of the risk adjustment. So if you're using something like the cost of capital approach, there's actually no need for you to calculate a confidence level other than the fact that you need to disclose it. The separation of the movement in the policy liability. So right now, our change in policy liability is just a change in policy liability for life insurers. Now we'll have to separate it into the interest component and the non-interest component, and then you have to do a reconciliation of your starting position of your CSM, your risk adjustment, and your other elements of the fulfillment cash flow. So there's lots of information required there. So in terms of disclosures, it's sort of something that happens at the end, not the start. So it's possibly not something that many people have put their thought to, but there is an enormous amount of work involved in order to get there. How many people have thought about the disclosures at all? Yes, we've probably got about 6 or 7 people. In terms of the information note that we've produced, do you feel that we've got the right level of information there? Are you feeling that we should have more in there? Right level of information? More? Yes, we've got about 2 or 3 with more. So if you were wanting some more information there, it would be good if you gave us some detail on what sort of information you wanted, particularly having referred to things like the illustrative financial statements that are available to sort of say, putting together information that's been produced by other sources, what more information should the actuarial profession be providing in this regard, as opposed to the accounting professions providing it. So I didn't have any more slides, and I've come in at about 10 minutes. So if there's any more questions, I'm happy to take them. Otherwise, I've got us almost back on track.
Hello, I just have a quick question, Briellen. Does the task force know whether the accounting profession is going to provide any information or guidance or anything on disclosures that we can leverage?
So at this point in time, I think KPMG's produced illustrative financial statements, which are available for free on the KPMG website. I'm not sure if you could tell me about Deloitte, and Brendan could speak about EY, I guess.
Yeah, I expect that most of the firms will produce something. I mean, EY's got something in progress at the moment. So hopefully there'll be information out there that's available eventually.
Briellen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for bringing us up to speed and up to date from an agenda point of view as well. Okay, so what we're going to do now is have a bit of a panel discussion about the commercial implications of the new standard. So if I can ask three people to join. So it's Anne Driver, and Scott Hadfield at the back has agreed at the last minute to sit in place of Lisa Simpson, who got caught in a traffic jam on the Melbourne freeway and didn't actually get on a plane. So please, and Briellen Cummings is joining us as well. So it's very easy for us all, I think, to get lost in the numbers and the complexities involved in the new standard. But this is going to have a fairly significant impact on the results of organisations. Profit emergence, profit amounts, the way the balance sheet looks, and a few other bits and pieces. And I think until companies have actually produced some real numbers and shown them to the CEOs and shown them to the board, then they're probably all just going to sit there and say, well, it's a new accounting standard, what's the big deal? However, once they see the numbers, you're going to see the level of interest go up through the roof, I think. So these guys here are going to try and predict what those implications might actually be.
No pressure at all.
So normally an accounting standard wouldn't really drive business strategy, but there is the potential for it to do so here. So let me pose a couple of general questions and then you can comment on them. So an example would be that product design might be influenced by the new accounting standard. So in other words, to get perhaps a better emergence of profit, you might see a change in product design. And I should point out too, Scott is here really with a health insurance hat on, even though he's not currently involved in health insurance. He's got plenty of health insurance experience. So we'll try and have general insurance, life insurance, and health insurance comments. So Anne, shall we start with you? Any observations on likely impact on products?
Is that better? Oh yeah. Look, I'd hate to say that an accounting standard should drive changes, but of course, inevitably they do. And thinking back to when 1023 came out, some 20-odd years ago, I'm not sure I remember significant changes in product designs, but certainly there were other changes, certainly around investment strategies, because all of the discount and investment gains and losses were going through P&L. So things do change inevitably, and I think probably on this, if we look back on the life standard, not that that's my area of expertise, but I do believe there were some changes that came out of that to once, you know, the new view of profit was recognised. I have to say on the general side, we're not seeing massive expectation of changes in profit profile, although obviously the discussions around coverage units are still ongoing. But clearly the area around onerous contracts and perhaps recognising onerous contracts at a more granular level could drive some changes through. I think the other one is likely to be reinsurance, where you know, it might just be simpler to have simpler products so you can get a simpler outcome, or to try and remove some of the asymmetry if we can't fix the standard. They're probably the two areas I'd call out where we might see some changes.
Okay, thanks. Bria?
I think on the life insurance space, the big question is where the yearly renewal term product ends up in terms of that contract boundary, in terms of, and what the rules are just regarding the clarity of what makes something long-term versus short-term. It's very easy to see that some people could introduce, you know, some small features such as loyalty discounts or something to push something into the long-term bucket if that's what they need, want it to be, rather than the short-term bucket. So I think that if people really did want to have a long-term contract boundaries for yearly renewable term, there's potentially things that they could do in terms of product design changes that would not be costly and would potentially be in a consumer advocacy type of thing to do anyway. The question I've had by so many companies is actually, will it change the cross-subsidisation of premiums to reduce the onerous level of potential level component of onerous contracts? That's an interesting one. It sort of assumes that as an industry we are price makers rather than price takers, and I'm not really sure if that is the case, so I think that's very much a wait and see. I agree with Anne completely on the reinsurance point. I think that's probably the one where companies actually have the most control over what may or may not happen, bearing in mind that reinsurance is currently optimised from a capital perspective in life insurance, and so trying to get a fine line where it continues to be optimised for capital but is also optimised for profitability, that's going to be an interesting challenge.
I guess from a health insurance perspective, I sort of approach it in two ways. First and foremost, accounting, actuarial, it's all good stuff, but cash comes in, we pay some expenses, more cash comes in, more cash goes out, end of day, we're left with residual cash. That's called profit. So all we're talking about is actually amortising and recognition of profit, and we must never forget that for everything we do. For the health insurers, I think they're really facing a couple of major issues. They're a relatively simple product. They all want to be short tail for obvious reasons. And so when they think about the issues here around product design, they're looking at more on the longer-term products, so the inbound students that have 2 to 3 year coverage for health products, so they get a long-term product that they really want to achieve as short-term, so they may well have some contract resetting maybe to tweak that product to help their cause if they can't get under the PAA. And then for me, the other one, of course, is the risk equalisation, the reinsurance industry, reinsurance issue that's there around what exactly is that, how will that fit into reinsurance, if indeed it is reinsurance, and how do they get the matching that they obviously would like to get through their earnings and volatility of earnings in the way they report their results.
Okay, thank you. Features of products, could that come into play, do you think, in life insurance? Probably not in general insurance. Have any impact at all? Redesign of products for new features?
I think only
removal of features.
If people are going there already, I mean, so much of our product design is actually designed around the customer these days that it seems, I know that several executives I've spoken to are sort of horrified at the thought that they would, you know, be walking away from that customer-centric view that we've been moving towards. But it's more if you're going to introduce something or take something away which would also be compatible with that customer-centric experience.
Okay.
So health insurers would be a great example where they've gone very customer-centric. So as many of you will know, there's points, there's air miles, there's discounts on books, there's discounts on services, and never mind the actual hospital and ancillary benefits that they have. So they actually have a lot of product streams that come into play, some of which are just clearly not insurance. So that separation of contracts issue is definitely something they may look at. And if all too hard, they could do some product redesign to simplify that or separate those services.
Hmm. Okay. So there's a bit of talk before about reinsurance and its effectiveness in terms of perhaps adjustments or impact on capital, impact on profit. So do you see some changes, therefore, in the use of reinsurance, first of all, and general insurance?
Well, so far I'm not seeing changes in the use of reinsurance. I think reinsurance is the one area where you look at when it was really tackled and how much it was tackled by the ISB, and I don't think it's something that they've had spent enough time on. So I do think it's one area we might see some change in, because some of the asymmetries that were mentioned earlier just don't make great sense. The ISB tend to look at reinsurance less as, you know, it's very much an insurance thing, but the nearest they see it as is hedging, equivalent to hedging. But even then, when we're doing, anyone who's been involved with ASB 139 or ASB 9, as it's going to be, we'll understand. I mean, there's a lot of effort goes into trying to get some symmetry in hedging. So it's interesting they think of it that way, and we're not seeing the symmetry that we need. I do think it's one area that's just going to change. I hope will change in the standard. But as of yet, I'm not seeing changes in expectations around the reinsurance products or strategies, with the exception of, you know, if you've got more control, to the point you made before, contract boundary as well, you know, if you can bring that contract boundary in and get a simplified approach, then logically you would. So anyone with captives out there would be looking at that. That's a very simple solution.
Brielle?
I think the same thing is broadly true for life insurance. I think that a lot of people entered into reinsurance for capital, for the purpose of capital release, to the extent they've entered into it for to smooth profits over, or to reduce the volatility of profits as well. If it's not achieving that, they'll rethink it. I guess the main thing about the reinsurance is it's actually still the same real world hedge it always was. It's just the accounting perspective. And I think that the entire reinsurance industry will globally be thinking carefully, in the extent that the accounting standard doesn't change, about what changes they could make in their reinsurance contracts themselves to try and reduce that asymmetry.
Health insurance? No. Okay. So to pick up Scott's earlier point about, you know, ultimately it's about presentation of results and so on, but unfortunately in the world we live in, presentation plays an awful important part, and that includes analysts and the press and boards and CEOs and bonuses for staff and management and so on and so forth. So what sort of education process do you think is actually going to be necessary? Do you think that those various parties I just mentioned will readily understand what's happening and adjust their thinking accordingly, or is there going to be a little bit of chaos here?
Shall I pick that one first? Definitely chaos. I think some already rating agencies and outside parties are starting to talk about IFRS 17. So there's clearly that building momentum. I would say one of the things that will drive some of the chaos is all the changing terminology. As we bring this sort of global landscape together, all the things that we know and love in 1023 and 1038 are going to be replaced by new terms. And so, you know, there's that journey that you've got to take people on around understanding, okay, you know, the profit may not change, but all the words that we're now using to describe that may change, or indeed the profit may change and why. So, early education on that is my watchword. We've already had taken our heads of audit and risk committees through this. You know, we're working with our financial planning analysis team. And the bigger you are as an entity, the more these groups are spread all over. And so there's a lot of work just to get people over the line to just understand that this is out there, 1/1/21. And to a degree, a lot earlier than that, you're going to have to start explaining your results in a new way, using new terms. And one of the other compelling factors, of course, is, you know, ASIC requires companies to explain what the impact of changes in accounting standards will be. So we'll be asked to explain these things before we actually have to put the new accounts out. Mm-hmm. So looking at what that future might look like and educating people on how to not just explain the result, but at the other side to understand the result, I think is key.
Mm. Oh, chaos is an understatement. I think the level of maturity is the bit that's varied quite dramatically. So whether you're in the life industry, general industry, insurance industry, or health, the maturity of where they're at is varied. We did start, as I described earlier, on first base in Australia, because we have a mature, relatively recent standard. But we've sort of nudged it through and debated it. The rest of the world has started behind and probably caught up, if not exceeded us in Europe, in terms of their thinking, the investment they're putting in, and the education, both the financial education plus also the training. So I think we've just got to be careful. We don't just carry on at this pace. We need to lift that pace. And then in terms of other facets, I'd say the accountants are there. The actuaries clearly are there. I think you've done a great paper here. So my personal
commendation to say well done on that. That's a very thoughtful, well-written paper, so well done. But then you step out that into IT land. You know, IT providers are just nowhere. That they're really starting late, and they're just getting now to build the platforms that we will need as the industry to use to deliver these. So they're late. Boards have started a journey, but not quite there yet. And then I get to CEOs who are interested because there's profits that they've recognised already that are going to be re-recognised in profit next year. So suddenly I'm relevant and I'm very popular in certain conversations. That's good. Equally, I can tell them that there's profits they haven't recognised that will never be recognised in the P&L, and that conversation flips to, go away, Scott, we don't want to talk anymore. So for me, that spark of interest is something we've got to be very careful with to make sure it's there and we spark the interest, because we need everybody, employees, REM, HR, like you say, to lift the bar and really come at this at 100 mile an hour with financial support, empowerment in terms of capacity and resources, and then actually a real genuine interest, because this is big, it's complicated, and as we heard earlier, time will just drift so quickly that we'll be fighting hard to make the deadline.
Well said, Brian.
I share the chaos theory. I think that none of us are really prepared for the global nature of this standard. We all think that our industries are special, and we think our country is special, so that Australian life insurance is different from life insurance anywhere else in the world. And so to suddenly be in a position where, you know, a general insurer in Australia will be compared with a life insurer in Canada, which might be compared with a health insurer in Malaysia, all looking at the same sort of financial statements in the same format and saying, well, all these numbers are equivalent. I don't think that we're quite ready for what that may look like or what the analysts globally are going to do with that sort of information. I think also it's a very interesting choice for insurers in Australia to make that choice on OCI versus P&L for the discount rates, because globally it is starting to look like more people might choose OCI. So even if for a simplicity point of view, it might be nice to do P&L. If you are a listed insurer, do you need to do the OCI just to reduce those levels of differentiation from a global perspective? It's going to be an interesting challenge to see what those analysts are ultimately interested in.
Okay. Let's pose a question to the audience. Would you be confident in sitting in front of senior management and the board and explaining the likely implications on profit as you sit here at the moment? If somebody came to you and said, tomorrow, you've got to go and talk to the board. So put your hand up if you feel confident that you would be able to explain broadly the implications on profit for your entity. Put your hand up.
Can I do a couple?
So put your hand up and keep it up. There's only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay? So that to me is a real worry. So in some ways, Scott, you were nice enough to say that we as a profession have done a fair bit of work. But clearly as a profession, and I guess the sort of muted response we got today when we posed questions to you as an audience suggests to me that as a profession, we've still got really quite a long way to go. So watch this space, I think. Okay. Here's an interesting question. So what is the benefit of AASB 17? Why are we doing this?
That's a tricky question.
Yeah.
The real benefit is the global comparability.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one thing, the one light I cling on to when I need to find something. I think, you know, there's a global comparability. It may make us do some things better that we probably know we should be doing already. And I'd say probably around onerous contracts. You know, there's probably more transparency likely from that. But the cost, general insurance, predominantly PAA, massive cost, but it's isolated around certain problem areas. And that's what we've been trying to gather the momentum to get change around, because it's just not justifiable for that cost to get the sort of outcomes we want. In fact, as we went through it, one of the first things that we did was look at our financial statements and the disclosure was that we would get out of the new standard. Actually, we were taking things out rather than adding them. So, you know, are we going to get better information maybe in very certain specific areas? But on the whole, you know, Australia was in a very good place. Certainly for general insurance, I don't think that, that feeling is quite the same on life insurance, but certainly in general insurance. But we are standing at this and looking at it from a point of view of very similar principles, but looking at an awful large amount of work to come up with something which really is giving us less information. So difficult one.
And your point about comparability, of course, is much more relevant for an international insurer like QBE than it is for a local health insurer or a local general insurer. And so I'm still sitting here wondering what the benefits really are. So, Brianne, enlighten us.
Look, globally, I think this is a good idea. I've been doing a lot of work in Asia, and they're going from sort of net premium valuation to IFRS 17, which is a huge jump, but is creating it is a huge amount of work for them, but the insight that they're getting on their balance sheets, et cetera. So I think Australia is just kind of a consequence of the rest of the world in that we needed this standard. It is a huge step forward internationally. Unfortunately, we were very close to there already. We'd just done it in a different format, and changing formats is very costly.
Job security. As an accountant, consultant, as an actuarial profession, you know, there is an element of job security, and I say that tongue in cheek, but we are going to be very highly relevant to society, to the industry in the next 3 or 4 years, and we've got a role to play. I think we must never forget, in the 2000s, Australia recognised this was a problem, and so therefore went to solve it themselves, and that's just classic Australian. I'm English. I came here for 2 years in 99. I never went home for good reason, right? Because I do love this country. And that agility, that sense of we can do something about this, it wasn't easy in the 90s. And I did do a lot of reading, and QBE didn't like fair value accounting in the 90s, but now like it. So we all change our minds. But there's something there that says we've done this, and we start from a good position. So is it better? Yes, it's probably borderline for us. But then if you flip to global, whether you're a global player or just a global an insurer who buys reinsurance in the global marketplace, IFRS 4 did not solve accounting for insurance. It just said you can adopt what you do locally, wrap in some onerous contract stuff, some disclosures, and we're done. That is just not good enough in today's world. So therefore, on a global stage, they had to have a solution. What we've seen today is that there are, you know, there's compromise, right? And we actually have one general model with two subsets, right? So there's three models. So it's not quite perfect, but they had to do something. When you signed Aviva accounts, you took those accounting in all those different countries, left them alone, stapled them together, and called it an insurance set of accounts. Well, that is just not acceptable in the capital markets. So something had to be done. That's the global burning platform. We're unfortunate because of Australia and where we started from, but it is what it is, and we do want to be an IFRS compliant nation, so therefore we need to move forward on that basis.
Okay, thanks. And you touched on the costs and the amount of work involved. So I'd get each of you to elaborate on that point a little bit. And what advice would you give to people in the audience in terms of starting the work, doing the work, and so on? To get to where they need to be by 1/1/21.
Okay, well, the cost element is interesting, and I can only speak really as a general insurer. The rest is hearsay from my life colleagues. But from a general insurer, one of the biggest cost factors is the thing we've mentioned before, which is the balance sheet disclosure of groups of assets and groups of liabilities. The other one was around the premiums received, which Brendan talked about in the PAA. They're big cost drivers for general insurance. I want them to go away, which is why we're working hard with the ASB TRG and the ISB TRG to try and push back on those. One of the interesting things about being on the ISB TRG is that we're not alone. And that's the real sense you get. We're actually talking a lot amongst companies who are all probably you know, pushed through a phase one impact assessment. They're pushing through, trying to figure out how they're going to apply this in practice. So what we're finding is a lot of these cost drivers are coming out. So, but that's the two biggest examples, I think, on the general insurance side. And where do you start? It's interesting because things are still moving. So how do you start? Because you've only got 1/1/21. We talked about comparatives for the year before. It doesn't leave an awful lot of time. The place to start is the place, I think, is looking at what you do now and leveraging what you do now. Classic areas around definitions of portfolios and making sure that you've got quite clear identification of your portfolios and that you leverage the way you do manage your business. I mean, there's a piece there. You're not trying to create something just for an accounting standard. Try and embed it and try and do that early. So if you can do that, you're going to actually maximize some benefits without spending too much because you're doing something you want to do anyway. So that would be one area. The other area is around the risk adjustments we talked about. I mean, if you're going to look at how you do your risk adjustments, how you're going to cascade that if you've got more than consolidating entities, there are areas around there I think you can do some very early work on. It's actually quite beneficial overall to your preparation of results. But and the other area is just making sure you're understanding what is happening and monitor what's going on so you can be prepared. I wouldn't have said if you're, for example, like we are a general insurer, yes, we'll have some small pockets of business that will probably have to apply the general model. We don't want to be the first ones to go out and build that model. So that won't be us. But and that's the thing, is find out what's important to you. Look at what your expected profile will be and what your expected model is you're using, and then just try and leverage what's out there and leverage what you already have. Another classic one is onerous contracts. Every general insurer is doing portfolio remediation. It has been since the dawn of time of portfolio. So don't throw that away and think, oh, I've got to do a new thing for onerous contracts. Look at what you can leverage, how you can do it better, and how you can just embed it into the standard. So they're the key areas I'd pick up.
Okay, thank you.
I think most companies are wanting to do some form of process improvement along with IFRS 17. If we sort of learn from our Solvency II colleagues in Europe, most of them didn't achieve any process improvements. Most of them struggled to actually get Solvency II in on time. And a lot of the costs that you see in Europe right now for life insurance companies is actually fixing up the mess that Solvency II left so they can now build IFRS 17. So I think if you are wanting to do process improvement, being really precise around what it actually is and making sure that it's actually part of the plan rather than thinking, oh, well, as we go along, we'll just identify these process improvements and they'll somehow happen, because they won't. And in fact, you'll get there and your budget won't be enough and you'll just struggle to get compliance in. The other thing that I would comment is when you start and you do that initial gap analysis, do it as broadly as possible. You don't want to be the company that gets a year and a half into their program and then thinks to look at executive remuneration and realise that there's 5-year options in there which are dependent upon current accounting reporting, and your executives aren't going to be too thrilled if you suddenly change the nature of that reporting. So identifying, the odd things early on that are going to actually prove to be very, very important is a good idea.
Well said. I think you have choices, right? So I think as a company, you're the big inner town should think of this as a transformational opportunity. You've suddenly got an opportunity to talk to the board and have a budget conversation, and therefore the chance to make change. If you're operating like a lot of the industry is in a smaller end of town or the medium end of town, you've got to choose what your path is. And I appreciate that money is tight and the environment means that it doesn't grow on trees. So therefore, a more compliance orientated process with some quick wins is probably the right sort of strategy to adopt. And we're not even into our APRA colleagues who may change things, and the ATO that may change things, and the foreign reporting that may change or be slightly aligned. And so there's just a level of complexity that will just be hard. But it is an opportunity to take stock and use that to leverage in to your boards to make a meaningful difference and improvement in your companies. On the business side, very quickly, I think there is a chance here to look at things slightly differently. You know, we as an industry have not done a great job around what we do and why we sell it and how we sell it. And whether that's in commission structures and trail commissions, and the Royal Commission's obviously underway, or indeed that portfolio analysis, right? We can and should have done a better job around portfolios. Group life, we should have priced that better over the last decade, and we've just got some of those things right now. This is a good way to
get the lens right, and it takes onerous contracts to force some of that up to the surface, and for some maturity in pricing and some to lift the bar. Well, actually, that's not a bad thing.
Yep, very true. While you're there, what advice would you give small insurers to ensure that they can actually implement on time? Apart from using a consultant, what advice would you give them?
Yeah, and it's a real challenge. I think for me, you've got to find some friends, and those friends might be mini clubs. So if you're in the health insurance industry, very fragmented, plenty of health insurers writing, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50, even 100 million of premium, but that's it. Run very skinnily in terms of profit margins and ability to finance. They need to find some friends and get some mini clubs together, I suspect, and then find a partner to help them and support them in that way, which might be HAMS, there's the IT provider out of Adelaide, to say, well, HAMS, you invest, and we'll all leverage off that. And they probably have the capacity to invest in an IT platform because they're selling their IT structure to the market as a whole. So I think there's a bit of coming together. I think there's a bit of responsibility. I think everyone's started a journey but haven't taken that baton in the hand yet. So you've got to get out there and invest some time, whether you're small or medium or large, you've got to invest some time.
Okay. We're running out of time. Questions from the audience for the panel? Yeah, in the back there.
Two questions. Firstly, as a professional, trying to make contact or trying to get answers, what's the best way an actuary can link into the TPG, I think it is, ask questions? Is there a process? We don't want to inundate the group, but presumably the group's going to be closest to all of the issues that are going on, and we're going to need that support. So just a question around how does that group support people actually applying it in the field? The second question, I noticed that we talked about 17 years or so in the development of this standard, and yet it's being, in my view, rushed in a very short period of time. We heard a lot of comments about the challenges. Is there a chance that this will be pushed back in terms of the timing, or alternatively, I take a very practical view, and I would try and get something in, even if it's not ideally the ideal solution, long-term solution, and continue to work with it over time. So there may be practical implementations that you can do that don't meet the full standard but are heading that way. So just a couple of questions on those two issues.
On the ways of getting feedback or raising questions and getting answers, I think one of the things that I took out of today is that we, the task force, need to give you a better facility to do that. So we'll take that away as an exercise.
Add to that. As Yanri from the ASB mentioned, there is a website with the ASB's TRG on it. You can see all the papers, the meetings, the minutes from the meetings. You can see who the members are. There is also a pro forma that if you want to ask questions, you can. But one of the criteria is that they have to be pervasive. So that sometimes may limit you if it's just very specific to you. And I think that comes back to Scott's point about finding your friends. I know I've certainly been working with the Insurance Council of Australia, and Eamon from the ICA is here. We've been, there's obviously the IAGs, Suncorps, QBEs at the table, but there's also many others, small and large, who are sitting around the table, and everyone's very open and happy to share their thoughts on the way we're practically applying this standard. So I hope that helps. But to answer the second part about, yes, it's been a long time. It has been a long time, a very long time. But a lot changed in the last couple of years, and I think what we're dealing with and some of the issues that we're finding and which are raised to the international TRG is some of those kind of late rush-ins, which is bizarre when it took so long. Anyway, but there were lots of reasons we'll not go into today. It is what it is. Can we just get close and work towards getting close? Well, I think you'd have to have a conversation with your auditors about that. And I think that's one of the filters that is coming through here. You would have noticed that on the ISB TRG and the AASB TRG, we've got the audit firms represented. I mean, there at the end of the day, you might go out and want to do something in a particular way. Is close enough good enough? Well, I'd be reading the ISB's practice statement on materiality. That's probably your friend in all of this. You know, is it materially acceptable? And then having that conversation with your auditors, you might want to comment on that.
I might comment slightly differently, which is that I think I started work the year that Moz came in, or the year after Moz came in, and I worked for AMP, and I can tell you that AMP's valuation process and the level of detail and et cetera around the valuation today bears no resemblance to what it was when I started. That I think that there is an idea that you start somewhere and then you build and evolve, and you don't necessarily need to start at the end, but the materiality question always needs to come into play.
Materiality is your friend, and good, robust documentation of your position and the evidence to support it is going to be critical in that, in answering that. I think to pick up the second point around the timing, there's politics at play, so there's pressures on people that are enacting themselves and appearing in ways that I just would never attempt to even fully understand. I think we will see a standard, but I can see one or two regulators around the world perhaps trying to defer it for a year, and I've heard rumours in Hong Kong and some other Asian territories. Quite the level of truth behind those, you never know. But the issue, one of the issues is SSB9 and aligning those two. So I think there are boundaries that say it will run its course towards 2021, and therefore there will be some, here's where we're at today, and there will be some progression post that date to refine it and improve it. Equally, there'll be one or two hand grenades that will be thrown in along the way, and they may disrupt that timetable, but I would definitely encourage everyone to work on the basis of it 2021 and build your plans around that.
Okay, thank you. Time for one last question. Yep, in the middle.
Thank you. When I think of the commercial implication side, it's not just the compliance aspect of getting this in play, but it's also how you're going to manage the business going forwards. So you've got things like the contract boundary question, not fully allocated expenses going forwards, and that's going to have all sorts of impacts on the kinds of numbers that are coming out. So I'm wondering, what role do the panel think actually should be playing around that particular issue? You know, maybe embedded values might come back in vogue, you know, because if you're only looking at 12 months ahead instead of, you know, the whole future, there's premium adequacy questions and so forth, or you might have very juicy looking margins, and all of a sudden DI doesn't look so bad at all after all, when it's not really the reality, is it? So those kinds of commercial implications around how we manage the business and IFRS 17, the adequacy of managing business just to IFRS 17. Interested in your thoughts on that.
Embedded value coming back, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it kind of went out when Moz came in. It's now kind of pretty much gone out of Europe with Solvency II coming in, and now we're thinking, will it come back? At the end of the day, if you're a shareholder company, the analysts are going to be looking at your published numbers, and you have to kind of think around, if you give an embedded value story along with published numbers, how are those stories consistent? I know that this is one of the things that concerns people with some of the short-term, long-term contract boundary issue, is that if your YRT is short-term, how are you explaining that your value of new business, or your value of 1 year's new business bears no resemblance to the CSM earned by your last year's new business? So I think that that is an interesting story as to how you're going to put that together and sell it to the market, and I don't pretend to have the answer at this point in time.
I would just say that I think from a general insurance point of view, actuaries are already in the frame in terms of, you know, analysing results. I think it will just strengthen. I think we'll see a lot more expectation around actuarial input, around that connection between the pricing and the reporting and results, and especially around the onerous contract explanations. I think a lot of people will be turning to the actuaries and going, can you just help me with this? So, yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting one to watch.
Okay.
Scott. Very quickly, look, no one likes change, and when you think you have a framework that works, it's even worse, right? So the change is even more painful, but it will change, and we'll find a landing place, and life will go on. There are things today that we don't like. You know, Moz is good, but it's not great. It works really well for some simple life products, but actually there's some nuances in there that don't work so well for annuities and so forth, and we report discount rate mismatches and so forth in a way that helps the capital markets understand what we do. Other industries spend a lot of money up front and don't capitalise every man and his dog and try and spread it over every product for 30 or 40 years, and they survive because they explain the value they bring and the capital expenditure they have and the positioning they have for future market growth. Well, we will find a way I think the thing we need to do is find a way to say, here are the facts, here are the rules, here's our position, and then think about how we then communicate the value we're creating in our businesses, whether we're a runoff business or a high growth business in Asia, for example. There'll be different ways we tell that story, but we will find a way. But we need to get the facts straight and then find a way to tell that story.
And I can see embedded value coming back, I have to say, on that note. We could carry on here for a long time, I think. So can you please thank the panel? They did a great job. We're 5 minutes past one. I'm going to finish very, very quickly. Thank you for your participation. I think we, the task force, have got a few things to take away, and we'll convene and do our best to address the issues that have been raised. There are two things I think that I would like to ask you now. One is just to get your views, given what's happened today and what you've heard, about the information note. So, and I need you to be honest, because as I said, there's a lot of work in this. So do you think that it is worthwhile continuing to pursue the information note, develop the information note as we intend? So put your hand up if you think, yes, that's correct. Okay, so, all right. So I think that's a good answer. Thank you very much. For those who didn't see that, nearly everybody put their hand up. The second thing is, and again, you need to be brutally honest, I think, was this exercise we did today worthwhile? And if we had time, I'd ask you for ways that we might improve it. But is a workshop like this worthwhile in, another 8-12 months? So if you think it would be worthwhile, let us know. Can you put your hand up? Yes, okay. So and if you're game, put your hand up if you think it's not worthwhile. Okay. There are a couple of very honest people, so that's good. All right, we'll take all of that on board, and we'll see you again perhaps next time. Thanks very much. All right.